This is Kelly Crager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. David Stroud. Today is 24 June 2009. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Stroud is joining us from Kilgore, Texas. Mr. Stroud, I want to thank you one more time for consenting to participate in this interview.
Well, you're welcome.
First off, let's start with some brief biographical information. Can you tell me when you were born and where?
Yes, sir. August 30th, 1944 in Tyler, Texas.
Tyler, Texas. What were your parents' names?
Vernon Stroud and Inez Stroud.
Okay. What did your parents do for a living?
My dad was an independent dirt contractor. He cleared things for oil leases and he owned a trucking company for a while. Mm-hmm. And my mother was a stay-at-home mom.
Very good. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, sir. I got a twin brother. I'm exactly 1 minute older than he is. And he didn't go to the Vietnam. He was in college, got the draft deferment. And when I came home, he told me, he said, "I hate to tell you, I'm against the war." And I said, "I'm glad to tell you, I don't want you over there." And I often ask him, I said, "What would you have happened if you got drafted?" He said, "I'd have gone." But he just never did. Mm-hmm. And to this day, he's as far from a wannabe as you'd ever. He's so proud. He said, "I think I was one of the first ones that came out against that war." But yeah, he's twin brother. I had an older sister. She died in 1980. And so that's the extent of my family.
Well, describe life for me, if you would, there in Tyler, Texas, which, of course, especially at that time, was a very rural part of the state.
Yes, sir. I said I was born in Tyler. I grew up in a little place called Joinerville, Texas.
Okay.
And it doesn't even have a slowdown sign. It's on the side of a road, Highway 64, between Henderson and Tyler. And it was named for Dad Joyner, who discovered the well in 1930, the discovery well that brought in the Great East Texas oil field. And we lived on, we call it a ranch, but we didn't do that all the time. My dad had about 180 acres or so, and we had cattle and stuff like that. Went to a little school called Gaston. It's on the side of the road. Elvis Presley once performed there on his way to Louisiana Hayride. It was just country life, you know. We rode horses and stuff like that and went hunting stuff. Just lived out in just did a lot of stuff out in the country and everything.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe life in terms of your socioeconomic position? You said your dad was an independent contractor.
Oh, definitely middle class. Yeah, middle class, maybe upper middle class. But yeah, everybody, yeah, we were doing pretty good. I don't think we were rich as everybody thought we were, but in those days, if you had anything, you were rich. But yeah, I would say middle class. Mm-hmm. Certainly not upper class.
Sure, sure. Well, what about your schooling? Where'd you go to school all the way through high school?
Okay, I went to Gaston, then I transferred to Henderson. I graduated from Henderson High School in 1963. And then you're going to find this difficult to believe, after playing football and all, they discovered I had a heart murmur. Hmm. And the way they discovered it, I went to enlist in the Marine Corps. And Navy corpsman discovered it and had to see a doctor. And so I had to have open heart surgery before I went in the Marine Corps.
Really?
Yes, sir. Back in 1964, right after I graduated from high school. I mean, 63. And once I did that, I had to have a letter from him, you know, to get in the Marine Corps, and it stayed in my service record the whole time. And I had to wait 6 months after that surgery before I could enlist. And I spent my 6 months working in the East Texas oil field. And then I went in the Corps in January of 1964.
But kind of prepare you for life in the Corps. Well, let me back up here a little bit.
Okay.
Tell me a little bit about school. You said that you played football through high school.
Yes, sir.
What sort of things did you do?
I played for, well, I started out in junior high at Gaston, but then I played high school in Henderson. Mm-hmm. We thought we had a good team. I don't think we were as good as we thought we were. But yeah, I played tackle, offense and defensive tackle.
What about school?
Didn't do very well. I did not care for school. My brother did. He did real well. I got out with as low a C average as you could. In fact, when everybody was going down to take the ACT or whatever for college, I remember I went to Dairy Queen because I was going to go in the Marine Corps. And then when I was in the Corps and decided to go to college, I got in SFA on scholastic probation. And that was my challenge. And my GPA, you know, I got out. I had a C average or something like that when I got out. But I found I really enjoyed it. I really did like it. I respected all those professors, and even if I didn't do good in the class, I just thought it was a great class. Mm-hmm. But I was not a student when I was in high school by any means.
Well, you mentioned that you intended to go into the Marine Corps when
yes,
you graduated
sir.
High school. What was it about the Marine Corps? Why did you want to enlist?
Okay, the reason, and the way I remember it, is my sister at the time was engaged to a guy I just think the world of. And when I first met him, she said that Ed was in the Marine Corps. I don't remember I'd ever heard of the Marine Corps. So I went home and I looked him up in the encyclopedia. And there was this sergeant in these dress blues looking at me like, if you think you're tough, you just try to come one of us. And that's when I got hooked. And then I started reading books like Battle Cry by Leon Uris and things like that. And my brother-in-law never told me to go in the Corps. He hardly ever talked about it or anything. But that's when I discovered him. And what I liked about him is called the reputation of being the toughest. Because at that time, I thought I was going to be one of the toughest and everything. And I liked him, you know, Iwo Jima and all that kind of stuff. I read everything I could on the Marine Corps.
Now, was your brother-in-law in Korea?
No, he wasn't. I talked about being a drill instructor as a corporal. He's a drill instructor as a PFC.
How did that
what happen? He did, now, he told me this, and I'm not documented, okay?
All right.
He was getting ready to go to Korea, and they had this night watch, a fire watch guy come by, and he went up just as playing around with him and knocked his helmet liner off. Well, it was dark, and the night guy didn't see who it was, and so he finally called him and said, what's your name? And he said, Jesse James. He told me it was the longest court-martial in Marine Corps history, impersonating Jesse James. And because he got court-martialed and it took so long, he missed the troop movement to Korea. And they didn't know what to do with him, so they sent him to San Diego to be a drill instructor.
That's quite a story.
And he showed me graduation photographs, and there he is, PFC, and this drill instructor senior was a corporal that had been a Marine Raider in World War II.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and like I said, he had no reason to make that up. He told me that's why he didn't go to Korea. He was being court-martialed at the time, and he didn't have enough time after the court-martial. They sent him down to San Diego to be a drill instructor if he got out.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yep, now, but he's the one that got me in. But like I said, he didn't tell me any stories or anything. It was that encyclopedia and the reputation of the Marine Corps. And I wanted infantry. I didn't even know about recon. I never heard of recon until I got to Vietnam. And I just wanted in the infantry, and that's what I got in. They gave me my wish.
No.
That's when you have to be careful what you wish for. But
right.
I'm proud I was in the infantry. But I tell you, it was as tough as anything I ever wanted to do.
Now, you are 18 years old, 1963. You just graduated high school. You say your friends are going off to take the test for college. You go to the Dairy Queen because you know you're going to go into the Marine Corps.
Yes, sir. I was going to go in for 20.
Now, you made this decision very, very early in your life.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned that you hadn't had all that much knowledge about the Marine Corps, but you were building it up over time.
I did, but as I remember, when she told me he would have been a Marine, I think I knew it was some branch of the service, but I didn't know anything else about it. That's why I went home and looked it up in the encyclopedia. And then, of course, I started seeing a few movies about it. A lot of those guys in my age got in the Corps because of John Wayne Sands of Iwo Jima. I never saw that movie after I was out of the Corps. I saw Battle Cry. Like I said, I read the book, and then I saw the movie. And there are probably a few other things. I read some histories of the Marines in the Pacific, and I read some of the novels of the Marines in the Pacific. And that's what I was reading. That's what really got me into it.
How aware were you as an 18-year-old in East Texas about what was going on in the world and what as a Marine you might be called upon to do? Were you aware of world events, global affairs?
Oh, yeah. We had the I'm trying to remember exactly when, you know, the Dominican Republic crisis. Mm-hmm. We had the Marines landed in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Of course, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, what that had to do. That's a couple of years before us and stuff. And when I went into the Corps, I just wanted to be a Marine. And then once I got in the Corps, because this is before Vietnam heated up, you know, we had a few advisors over there, but we hardly ever heard anything about Vietnam. And once we got to Okinawa, the infantry battalion I was in, we definitely wanted to go to Vietnam. And, you know, in boot camp, they'd make us pray for war every night. Pray for war, peace is hell. Yep.
Okay, well, it sounds like that you made this decision, although maybe global affairs wasn't something that was...
No, it wasn't. It just wanted to be a Marine.
Just to be a Marine.
Yes, sir.
You've made that
And I'll tell you, I had to go from Henderson to Dallas to enlist. And when I was getting ready to sign the papers, and I figured since I graduated from high school, I would ask a smart question. So I asked the recruiter, I said, if I enlist the Marine Corps, what can you promise me? And he looked at me, and he said that if you make it through boot camp, you'll be a Marine. And I said, that's all I want. And I signed as quickly as I could.
So you signed up, but you had to go through the physicals, of course. And this is
I had to go through another one.
Heart problem.
Yeah, this was signing up, and then this was the second time. At one, you know, and they still have it now where you could do an early enlistment.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it was as long as it is now. And I had it timed that if I enlisted then I wouldn't have to leave till right after high school graduation. And that's when they discovered I had that heart problem.
Okay.
So once I got over that, I had to go back through it again.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about this surgery that you had. It's a heart murmur, but this can be any time they're working on an organ like that. It's very, very serious business.
Oh, it is. Oh, yeah. I tell you what, I got a scar from the middle of my chest to the middle of my back. And this was like in the dark ages compared to now.
Sure.
At Gaston Hospital in Dallas. And I was young and tough then, though. It didn't take me long to get over it.
Mm-hmm. Did you consider for any length of time that maybe this condition was going to hold you out of the Marine Corps?
Nope. In fact, I asked the surgeon that day when they took me down. I said, if I have this surgery, can I get in the Marine Corps? And he said, yes, sir. And I said, that's all I want to know.
So it obviously went very, very well.
Oh, it did. It did. And I was too young and stupid and gung-ho to even worry about anything like
right.
that.
What was your recovery period like?
When we had surgery over there at Gaston, I don't remember. They didn't have intensive care, I don't believe. But I was up on a certain floor where all the heart surgeries or something like that was. And my friend from high school came to see me. And he stuck me in some blue jeans and a T-shirt. And we went out and got hamburgers. And when we came back, I told them I needed to get back up to that floor. And they thought I was lying because there's no way I would be out. And I had to pull my shirt up and show them the stitches. And they let me back up there. I'm not near as tough anymore. Oh, yeah, he brought me in some old blue jeans and a T-shirt, and off we went.
Oh, very good, very good.
I was only there, I could tell students I wasn't taking notes. But I think I was out of there in like a week, maybe even less than that. And then, of course, I couldn't go to work in the oil field for a while, but it wasn't long until I was doing it. And that was pretty heavy-duty stuff.
Right, right.
I wasn't even concerned about that holding me back in the Corps or anything like that.
Okay, but you said it had to be 6 months after the
surgery. They told me, if I remember right, I had to 6 months before they let me go back to the Corps.
Okay, so you were biding your times then, I guess.
Yes, sir, and I worked in the oil field.
What was it like biding your time in the oil fields in the 1960s? The Marine Corps?
We worked for a guy who was, are you familiar with the oil field and what workover rigs are?
Somewhat, yes.
Yeah, I did workover work for a place called Major and Garvin out of Turnitown. And if I remember correctly, we worked 7 days a week, and if you weren't there at 6 a.m., because we had a crew of four, you were fired. And then they had people inside waiting for a job, and one of them would take it. And if you came back, you had to take your turn again and wait until somebody else didn't show up.
Yeah, that sounds like the typical kind of approach to...
Yes, it was. Uh-huh. And that was it. And so as I recall, we worked 7 days a week because there was so much business at that time.
I assume you're looking forward to getting out of the oil fields.
Yeah. I kind of liked it. It was that macho stuff. I didn't like doing it 7 days a week. But it was, you know, they used to have a saying that oil gets in your blood, and I could kind of see how that did that.
Well, it would be good training, I think.
Help
continue to toughen you up.
It was rough. It wasn't easy, especially if we did it in the summer and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'd done that when I was going to high school, you know, during the summer some. The other thing we did, of course, growing up was we loaded hay and that kind of stuff. But, I'd work out in the oil field in the summers, too.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, you say you joined, but you reported, what was it, in January of 1960?
Yes, sir. I actually enlisted then because the first time, see, nothing happened. I don't recall that I signed any papers. I don't remember. But everyone, regardless which service you were going into, went through this physical. And because I didn't pass that physical, I didn't sign any enlistment. I don't recall signing any enlistment papers or anything. But then after I got the 6 months with that letter, I went back up to Dallas, and that's when I enlisted. That's when I did the physical again. That's when I signed the enlistment papers and didn't come home after that.
Okay. Now, you said that you had intended to serve 20 years in the Marine
Corps. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I was going to make it 20 years minimum.
Okay.
And I tell people today, I don't know when that went to Plan B, whether it was boot camp or the infantry. But it was one of those two. I decided four for the Corps was enough.
Yeah. Well, there you were in Dallas. Did you go to North Carolina or did you go to California?
No, went to California, San Diego.
All right.
Now, in the Corps, and I think it's still like this, west of the Mississippi, you go to San Diego.
Okay. Tell me about your time in boot camp. Tell me about Marine Corps boot camp as best you remember it.
It was rough. And it was 3 months, and I was in 1st Battalion in San Diego. The drill instructors, they'd hit you. They just knocked the crap out of you. And the first time when we got in there, I didn't know this, but when you get into the airport, you don't get picked up to go to boot camp until, I believe, it's 3 a.m. in the morning. They don't want you coming in rested. Everybody comes in at 3 a.m. in the morning. When it's dark, you don't know where the hell you are, and these guys with the DI hats on, they're not DIs, but we didn't know that. And they jump on that green, we called it a cattle car, and they start screaming to get off that damn bus and get on those yellow footprints, where you'd be kind of standing at attention. And we got off, and I don't think it was me, but somebody, there weren't enough footprints for everybody. And that Marine went over and just knocked them. Crap out of that guy and told him to get on them damn footprints. So he hit somebody else, knocked him off, and got on the footprints. That was our introduction. We went in, we get the haircuts and all that, and then we got something called a bucket issue. Now, this is about as humiliating as you can get. You got your head shaved, and you're in these stupid green, we call them utilities and everything. You're on your damn knees, and they're just screaming at you. And we had this thing called the bucket issue. That was one or two pair of utilities, a razor. We called it shaving gear, toothbrush, and all that. They were doing an inventory. And so this sergeant or corporal, whoever he was, he'd yell out an item, and we had to hold it up. And I remember he yelled out toothbrush, and I could not find that damn toothbrush in that bucket. I put up an empty hand. So he came over, and he reached right down and found that toothbrush. And he accused me of trying to steal that from Uncle Sam and was beating the crap out of me with that damn toothbrush.
How did he do that?
Just hitting me on the damn skin head with that damn toothbrush. It didn't hurt, but it's as humiliating as you can get.
Right.
And he's screaming at me, I'm trying to cheat the government and all that kind of stuff. And then my brother-in-law had told me, the day I was getting ready to leave, he said, I'm going to tell you two things. Don't wear any clothing up there that you ever want to see again. And don't wear a watch because you're not going to need to know what time of day it is. They got to keep up with that. And I had these old jeans or something. Now, I'll tell you, we were terrified while all this was going on, all this screaming and the knocking the crap out of people, you know. And we had to put our civilian clothes in this box and address them. And I remember he said, I don't want you to address it to Podunk, USA, that nobody ever heard. Well, nobody ever heard of Joinville, Texas. So I put Dallas. When they saw that, they accused me of killing John Kennedy. I mean it right there. That you killed our president, you killed our commander-in-chief, and I tell you what, and I never saw those clothes again. I guess they're up in Dallas somewhere. Oh, they'd do anything. And we hadn't even met the drill instructors. Now, once I became a drill instructor, I know what was going on.
Right.
We didn't know that. That we had platoons and four platoons to a series. And I was a drill instructor at Parris Island, by the way, because I went there from 2nd Marine Division. And we had to wait until we had the four platoons before we actually start boot camp. Well, when you had enough for one platoon, we had about 78. Those drill instructors would pick them up. But you stay in this thing called receiving barracks until you get that platoon made. Mm-hmm. And then the drill instructor would pick you up, and they just... You hadn't even started training, but they would start doing, some preliminary stuff. So once you got the four platoons for them, that's when you started your training. So what we were going through was in receiving barracks, because we didn't know that. And then it was that night, our drill instructors, what we call, picked us up and took us to a squad bay. We had to make our racks, got in the racks, sang said goodnight to Chesty Puller and all that. Mm-hmm. He turned those lights off, and I swear to God, 30 seconds later, he turned them damn lights on. And it was reveille, and we were up and moving. We didn't no sleep that night. And I don't remember what time they got us up. It was probably about 6 a.m., maybe been earlier than that. And when I was a drill instructor, I found out that the Marine Corps wanted recruits to have 8 hours sleep, not 8 hours in 1 second. And so whatever it was, we got our 8 hours, but the rest of the 24 hours, we were busy. And, of course, learning to march and doing all that stuff that they did. And it lasted for 3 months, which seemed like an eternity.
What was it like for you as a young, I assume, independent Texan, 18, 19 years old, to be thrust into this kind of environment?
Oh, it was strange. Now, I knew about some of it because I'd read about boot camp and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you didn't know anybody, but you made boot camp friends, you know, like the guy that was in the rack next to you or something like that. We didn't have a lot of time to visit either. But you had a few friends. And I think I was pretty well prepared for it because I'd seen these movies and I'd read these books about boot camp and everything like that. It didn't bother me. I knew these DIs, although they've knocked the crap out of you. You know, they come up and ask you which side of the street your mother made the most money on and stuff. That didn't bother me at all. But I hear people now that they just send a ballistic. You don't talk about my mama like that. Of course, in my Marine Corps, you even say anything like that, they knock the crap out of you.
Sure, sure.
I mean, and so that's why I wonder about some of these guys. You may have been able to say that in the Army, but you're not going to say that in the Marine Corps. And they would do whatever they could. If they found there was something that you didn't like, man, you just get ready for it because they're going to let you have it.
What sort of things didn't you like?
Well, it didn't bother me. You know, they.
Okay.
Of course, when you ask which side of the street your mother had made the most money on, how do you answer that? You know, the right, the left, north, south, she does. There's no way to answer anything like that. And most of those questions I found out, even when I was a DI, you ask them, well, there's no correct answer, so you knock the shit out of the guy.
Right, right. What sort of things did you do the best, do you think, while you were in basic?
Oh, I think I could march pretty well. I went in... I was a little bit overweight, not anything like these guys are today. I think I went in about 195, and at that time, we were called fat bodies. So when we went to chow, fat bodies had to go to the rear of the line. And then when going through the chow, the recruits in there serving, they knew that once this overweight guy came, we got like half of what they gave you. And we got so much exercise, and it wasn't long. I was out of that. I went from about 195 to about 175 in boot camp. And I don't remember anything I did best. I thought I did it all pretty well. You know, I qualified with a rifle. I didn't shoot expert. Everybody says they did. I shot marksman. But it wasn't the lowest. It wasn't the highest. All they cared about was qualifying. I thought I could march good. Heck, we all could march good.
Right.
I just thought I was a good Marine.
No.
I did everything pretty well.
At the end of your boot camp, as you see it approaching, probably praying for that, you're looking
Day
for graduation there, and you realize that, by God, I'm going to make it through this.
Mm-hmm.
What did you want to do? You say that you wanted to go to the infantry, and this is 1964.
Mm-hmm.
What did that mean to you? Where did you hope to be stationed? What sort of things did you want to do?
I wasn't thinking about it. I knew that it wasn't that I hope I go to the 2nd Division or anything like that. I just knew I wanted the infantry. And I really didn't care after that. And I didn't think, you know, well, I want to be a machine gun. I just wanted to get in the infantry. And, once you start seeing the light at the end of the tunnel in boot camp, man, you talk about sharp. Oh, we were sharp and everything. But anyway, I didn't think about it like that. I just knew I wanted to get in the infantry. And shortly before graduation, they read orders to us. So we all knew where we were going. And I knew I was going to go at this time, 1st Marine Division. So I knew I was going to the infantry. And at that time, when we graduated from boot camp, you didn't come home on leave. We went up to Camp Pendleton for 1 month of infantry training, which we called ITR. And then after that, you went home for 30 days.
Well, tell me about ITR before we bring you back home.
Okay. That was you lost a lot of your friends. It was basically the series went up there, but I don't remember staying with the guys in my platoon from boot camp. And it was nothing but infantry, and it was and there where boot camp you got 8 hours sleep, not up there. we'd get out in the field, and we did just like in the infantry. You know, you ran, what you learned were how to familiarize yourself with the different weapons, M14, M60s, 3.5s, flamethrowers. You learned about squad tactics, platoon tactics. You stayed out in the field. They had this gigantic mountain they called Old Smoky. And we'd have to hump, you know the word hump. Well, we'd have to hump that damn thing. And, I mean, it taught you what the infantry was going to be like. And it, because everybody in the Marine Corps is supposedly infantrymen first, whether you're a clerk or anything. And it was a familiarization with the infantry. We fired mortars, flamethrowers, M60s. And we lived in squads and platoons. So we ran squad and platoon tactics and stuff like that. And it lasted for 1 month.
So you got 1 month at ITR, and
yes,
you're going to go back home.
Yes, sir. I had 3 months boot camp and 1 month at ITR, and then I went home, I think, for 30 days, because all that was going in the 1st Marine Division, 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines. We were what was known as a we were going to transplant with a 3rd Marine Division battalion in Okinawa. And I knew that. I knew that when I came home, because when I left, I told my dad, you know, go in and sell my 60 Impala because I'm not going to be coming back for a couple of years. So I knew I was going overseas then. And we were in the 7th Marines at Pendleton, I think, for a couple of months before we actually moved over to Okinawa. And we took the place of 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines, and they came back and became MAC 37 in 1st Marine Division. And that was in August and September. We went over on a troop transport called, it might have been the General Man. And that was miserable.
Why was it miserable? Tell me about the trip over.
You got down, and it's just like in these movies where, if I remember, they had this whole damn battalion down in the hold of that ship. And they had these racks, and they were just from the floor to the ceiling. There might be six or seven guys sleeping, and it was almost like if you had to turn over, you had to get out of that damn thing. Well, not long after we started, people started getting seasick. And I swear, I think I was the only one to get seasick. And the only reason I didn't do it is I had to tell myself, if I stopped laughing at those guys, I was going to get sick as they were. There's that rock into that damn ship. Man, they were puking in the racks. There was puke everywhere. And nobody could clean it up because everybody was sick. And you'd literally in the head, you'd see this puke just rolling as that ship rolled back and forth, And as far, but other than that, it wasn't bad, except there was nothing to do. The chow lines were so long that you'd form for morning chow, and it seemed like with about 1,000 jarheads, you'd be circling around the top of that ship. And by the time you got through with breakfast, morning chow, you'd get in line for dinner and then supper. And all you did was just wait until they sent you down to go to sleep at night. Of course, there were certain times you had to do that. But no, we didn't do anything. We didn't have any work details or anything like that. It was kind of boring.
Now,
it was about 38 days on that ship.
We got 38 days, okay.
About 35, 38 days. We got a little time in Hawaii, but we didn't have enough money to do anything except go to a bar and get some beers and stuff.
Well, tell me about that. Tell me about stopping in Hawaii. This must have been quite a treat for us.
It was. Oh, my gosh. It was about the fifth day out. And they told us we're going to get, I forget how many hours we had, and we're going to get liberty. And my buddies and I, we went to the nearest bar that we could go because there, as I recall it, drinking age was 18 or whatever. And so we went there, and I remember I was going to send a postcard home to my mom and dad. And when I was addressing it, I asked the person if I had to put United States of America after that. And she said, where the hell do you think you are? And so I decided that I didn't have to put USA when I put Texas down there. But we basically just got drunk. I swear to God, that's what we did. Not so drunk we couldn't get back or anything. We didn't do the sightseeing or anything like that. But I remember that's when I had my first German beer. And I got some pictures of all this, too. You know, we've got little Kodaks taking pictures of us doing all that kind of stuff. But that was fun. I don't recall going to Pearl Harbor or anything like that. We just went to the bar and then drank until we had to go back to that ship.
Then you got back on the ship. Did you have any problems after having drank so much?
I don't remember like being sick or anything like that, and I don't know why. I don't think we got so drunk that we couldn't get back. because I don't remember that. I just remember that it was fun because, as I understand it, we were legal over there. It may have been 19, and maybe 19 was the age, but we were legal over there. We couldn't have gotten it. So or we wouldn't have known where to go get it.
You make it to Okinawa eventually.
Yes.
At this time, again, 1964, did you believe that Okinawa was going to be where you were stationed for this trip?
We knew, yeah, that's where we're going to be now. So we didn't know about Vietnam. We knew they had some advisors down there. But there was nothing like, oh, by the way, you're going to be going to Vietnam from here. We assumed that's where we would be a whole overtime. Our whole tour overseas was going to be Okinawa. Mm-hmm. And we were up in the northern training area, a place called Camp Swap, mm-hmm. named for a Medal of Honor recipient in World War II. And it was jungle. That's one of the reasons they put us up there. And we did that always out in that jungle all the time.
Well, what sort of things were you doing in there in Okinawa then?
Okay, we would, if I remember correctly, old dark 30, before daylight on Monday morning, we're going out into the field, we're going out in the jungles, and we're going to do this stuff, you know, squad tactics, maneuvering and stuff like that, set ambushes at night. And we're going to do that from Monday until late Friday night. And then we're going to come in. And I mean, and they didn't, you know, if you got 2 or 3 hours sleep that night, you were lucky. I think that's something that really helped my battalion. We trained like that before we went to Vietnam. And we were good. I mean, we trained like for several months like that. And Vietnam, the only difference was they were using live ammo. I mean, we were just as miserable and as filthy and as sleepy and everything. I mean, you talk about practicing to be miserable. We were doing that. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we'd do. We'd set ambushes and squad tactics, platoons and stuff like that in the jungles. And, of course, the people that we're supposed to learn how to navigate through the jungles and stuff with the compass. And I don't think we were out there all the time because I remember one time they sent us on this long hike. They didn't know what else to do. So we went like a 75-mile hike or something like that. But as I remember, we were up in those jungles a lot during jungle warfare, ambushes and stuff like that. And then we come in on Friday and we clean up, clean your weapons and everything. We'd have inspection the next morning. And about noon on Saturday, we got Liberty Call. And that's where we hit the bars. And you had to be back. They had what was known as Cinderella Liberty. You had to be back at midnight. And so we'd come back at midnight, and then next morning, Sunday, we'd go back up there. And then we'd come back in a little bit earlier because we're going to go out in the field the next day. So we didn't stay quite as late on Sunday night. But that's what we did on the weekends, you know, the beer and the women. So the big beer was a dime a bottle. The women were $2. $2. $2. $2. And the bars were, had American names like Bar Texas, New York, and stuff like that. Country right. Western on the jukebox. I tell you, that's the best time. And your best buddy sitting there drinking with those. Oh, that was a great time on those Okinawan bars like that.
Yeah, they were
something else. I didn't realize this until then. That each one of these units, like a company and stuff, mm-hmm. we kind of had our own bar. I don't know if it was intended that way, but for some reason, Marine tankers don't like infantry. And when I'd go and I couldn't find my buddies, I'd go into a bar, and if it was tankers or somebody, they'd say, you better get your ass out of here. And I'd go down, and I'd go into another battalion's bar, and they'd say, you better get your ass out of here. And I'm looking for Delta. And I finally found it. They kind of had their own bars over there. And even though you were a Marine, you didn't just go into anybody else's bar.
Do you think that was part of a reflection of the cohesiveness?
Yes. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And it, you know, it just worked down. You know, infantry against tanks, and if you were infantry, depending on what company, what battalion you're on, and all that kind of, it was a brotherhood. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we didn't realize this. That's one reason we were with our buddies so much. And I don't remember how we got the bars or anything like that, but I remember going in the wrong ones looking for somebody. And they let you know you better get your ass out of here. Yep, now I'm looking for Delta. I'm looking for Delta Company or something like that.
Right.
But as you know, in the Marine Corps uniform, you can't tell what unit a guy's in or anything. You got no patches. You got no insignias or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And we just got the green uniform. And, of course, in those days, we had khakis and what we call tropicals, which looked like a really expensive khaki. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, they couldn't tell who you are, so you just they'd ask you, you know, who you were. I remember that, too, but that's what we did in Okinawa. And then in January of 65, I didn't know this, but one company of Marines had been guarding the airport at Denang. I don't know when they started that. And my company, Delta Company, 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines, was selected to go do that in January of 65. When the other companies learned that we were going, there was a fight out there in the street because the other three companies wanted to go. And a first sergeant stopped that fight by promising every one of those guys, you're going to Vietnam, you're all going. And that's what stopped that fight. Huh. That's how we wanted to get to Vietnam. And we flew in on C-130s in January and relieved whatever company was down there. I don't know who it was. Had the strangest uniform. It looked French. But the uniform for that company guarding that airbase was we had our combat boots on. We had green utility trousers, cartridge belt M14, helmet, but a khaki shirt instead of the regular Marine Corps one. And that, to me, looked French. And that would just let them know you were one of the Marine Guards there.
Right.
And we did that until March the 8th when they flew in the rest of the battalion. That's when Lyndon Johnson ordered the two battalions to go to Da Nang into Vietnam. And the other three companies, the 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines, came in by C-130s at the Da Nang Airport. And I think it was 9th Marines that landed down at Red Beach that day.
Right.
Yeah. And I think they went up to Hill 320. We eventually moved up to Hill 327. In fact, the only letter I've got is I'm telling my mom and dad that we're going up on Hill 327 tomorrow. And so I got that date on there, but I don't remember what it was. And then on 327, that's where our bunkers and everything were. And then we would go out in the bush by chopper. We didn't have an LZ up on Hill 327. We had to get in six bys. And they'd take us down to the bottom of Hill 327 to where the choppers were. And of course, these weren't Hueys. These are those big old grasshopper-looking things.
Right, the 34s.
Probably. Yeah, that's what we were in. Because there weren't, to my knowledge, there were no LZs up on Hill 327. And I think we went out. Normally just platoon size, very few times maybe company size, very seldom in battalion size. And I think we'd go out, and I was thinking about this before you called. I don't think we ever very often went out and came back the same day. I think we'd go out, and the way I remember it, we'd be out there for 3 days, 3 days and two nights. And we'd be doing search and destroys, patrolling and stuff. And of course, all this stuff was set down. The lieutenant would brief us before we went out. And then, of course, where the LZ was going to be. And every night we'd set an ambush or something like that. Then we'd be at the LZ like on the third day at a certain time and get picked up and brought back to Hill 327. And then you went down. Now, on Hill 327 up at top, we had some tents. And during the day, we had 25% security on Hill 327. And so you weren't in the bunker, you could go up there and lie around in the tents on the cot and stuff like that. But every evening, as soon as it started getting dark, everybody went back down to the bunkers and everything. And that's where our rear area was. And so we were still in a combat area. And every night, the artillery and the firefights, every damn night, you could see them. You could see the tracers and everything. Even if they were so far away, you couldn't hear the sound. You could see the tracers out there. And the artillery would be coming over us on Hill 327 if they had a fire mission. But most of the time, they were just firing flares. And they would come over 327. We'd hear them coming over. And then that pop, and that flare would start coming down. And they kept the flares going all night long, of course. And so when we were back on 327, that's what we were doing.
Well, let me interrupt you here, Mr. Stratton, and ask you this question. There you were on Okinawa. You are literally fighting to get to Vietnam. And this is
wanting to get to Vietnam,
In late 64 and early 1965 when you get there. What did you know, if anything, about what was going on there?
Not a damn thing.
Communist forces in the north.
And we didn't care. I'm sorry to say that. We did not care. Now, we knew the French had been there and got beat. Mm-hmm. That's all we knew. Now that I've studied it, I taught a course on it for several years. And I learned a lot that I didn't know then. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew the French were there and got beat. That's all we knew. I think they maybe they said something about stopping the spread of communism. But the way we were, we could care less while we were there. It did not matter. We just wanted combat.
What were your perceptions of who your enemies would be? What did you think about them? What did you think about the North Vietnamese? What did you think?
We didn't know about them. We knew there were North Vietnamese, mm-hmm. and they hadn't come in the war. They're not going to come in big time until, of course, the Army runs into them down, and I'll mispronounce it, down in our trunk. So we're fighting BC. To be honest, I didn't give them much thought, and I didn't like them, and I didn't dislike them. They were just the enemy. I really didn't. I did not think of them as human or any, they were just it. That's all they were. I did not like Vietnam. I didn't like it at all. I didn't care for the people. That doesn't mean I went through and, hit anybody or anything like that. I just knew this is not a place I would like to be. The whole country stank. Oh, the whole place stunk. But in the Marine Corps, and were you in the Marines or anything?
No, sir, I didn't.
We are brainwashed, and that's the best way I can put it. That even in boot camp, you are trained unless you are killing your enemy, you just not shit. In fact, before we went to qualify on the rifle range, we took our M14s into a chapel, and we had a chaplain give a special service with our M14s there. We had a sergeant that was in World War II. He wasn't a drill instructor. This was a treat when I was with my platoon. Our senior said, "We're so lucky we got this guy down." And he'd been in World War II in Korea, had ribbons. He got tears in his eyes telling us how he hoped and prayed that we would get combat, that we would get to feel combat someday. It's the greatest. He was crying. He was so sentimental. So that's the way we were trained. And they didn't say, you care about your enemy. You just go in there and kill them. And it didn't matter who they were. We would have killed them. And so we didn't think anything about it, like, we're in their country. This is really their land. None of that. I guess the best analogy is like a football player. It's a go in and knock the crap out of that linebacker. You just go do it. You don't really care about them. But I didn't think much about them as anything like that. Really didn't. I don't remember hating them. Now, we did go on a patrol, and we found, believe it or not, up in those jungles, we ran into a base camp, a VC base camp. And I swear, if they'd been there, I wouldn't be here. I would guarantee you that. And we'd ambushed their rear guard. And the firing in the jungle was so thick. On the other side of that base camp, there were eight of them sitting around eating rice. And we killed them. They didn't hear the firing down there. That's how thick that jungle was. But when we were going through that base camp, now I didn't go through it. I was platoon radio operator, and the squads were searching it real quickly. And I remember somebody brought back two things to show that, three things. Brought back a VC flag, and he found it folded in one of the hooches down there, and a Lone Star feed sack. I thought, being from Texas, my God, how did they get that? And I swear, starched khaki uniforms, which we knew were North Vietnamese. So we figured they had some North Vietnamese advisors down there at that time. And that's what we thought about it. We didn't know they were coming in. We just figured they were North Vietnamese down there now. But all I fought were the VC.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, do you remember, and you may not be able to do this, but do you remember the first of these missions you went on, the first of the search and destroy?
It's hard to me because these things are just all messed up. I can remember the first time I got shot. I got shot at. We weren't in a jungle. We were going through a rice paddy. We were on the dikes, and a couple of rounds came by us. And me and about six others all thought they were aiming at us. That's why I say I think I got shot. We all thought they were shooting us.
Of course.
Because it sounded like it was right there. And believe it or not, it hurt my feelings. Because all I could think about is I hadn't done anything to you, and here you are trying to kill me. Hurt my feelings. You don't even know me. You're trying to kill me.
What was your response to this?
Sir?
What was your response to this?
Oh, we just fired. That's just what I thought in my head, It hurt my feelings because you don't even know me, and you're trying to kill me. And, of course, we returned fire. But where he was, we couldn't have hit him. He was probably some sniper that wasn't very good, and we just fired back in the general direction and let it go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the firefights are just all messed up. You know, which ones came first and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, there was one, and I tell this to my students. It's the only thing I tell them. And, you know, I'll answer a question, but I don't do Vietnam now. It's a 1302, and I go into, hopefully go into a little bit more detail than just a textbook, but there's just so much I don't get to Vietnam anymore.
Sure.
So I get through World War II. And one of the things I want them to do is to appreciate these people that fought that war. So I tell them about Bob Dole. I tell them about Jimmy Stewart, you know, stuff like that. And I show them Willie and Joe Up Front by Bill Malden. And I told him, I said, I know I read this book when I was in eighth grade. I didn't just look at the cartoons, I read it. And I said, but one day in Vietnam, we come out of the jungle, and we heard the pops of mortars, and we knew we were getting mortared. And I went down on the deck, and I remember when those mortars were coming that I had two thoughts. One was, what will my parents think when they found out I'm dead? And the other one was, it's true. And it's true referred to a cartoon in Up Front by Bill Malden, which I show the class. It's Willie and Joe on the ground, hugging the ground with German machine gun fire over. And one of them says to the other one, I can't get no lower buttons in the way. And that's what I remembered when I was hugging that damn ground, that button was in my way. And it's true. Word of God, that's what I remembered. And the point I tell my students is this was humor that combat people could see, that those that hadn't couldn't see it, because I just thought it was funny, you know, because the button isn't big, until I was on that ground that day. And then I realized what they were talking about. And that's the two things I remember that day.
What was it like for you? You've already talked about this kind of humorous moment, the first things that came through your mind, but what was it like for you to be in a position of where you were, like you mentioned, you're utterly helpless
here? You were. You're just totally helpless.
What goes through your mind?
We lost a couple of guys and some wounded. In fact, one of these guys, you know, and, you know, we hear this all the time, the good ones are the ones that get killed, and it's so damn true. And this guy was a kid named Fernandez, and he wasn't my best buddy, but I knew him. He was in my platoon. And I remember that he didn't drink beer, and he didn't go whore around or anything like that. He didn't cuss. And he got killed that day. And I found out from the corpsman, the only cuss word he ever said was the next to last word he ever said. He said his first cuss word when he was dying. Isn't that something?
Amazing.
Yep. And what had happened is the corpsman was telling him to hang on. The choppers were coming. And he said, F you. And died right there.
Wow.
Yeah. And of course, I didn't know that. You know, people, all I do is tell what I saw when I was there, and people say, you know, they're getting killed in front of me. Well, they're getting killed close to me, but I wasn't seeing that stuff. I learned that later on from a corpsman. I knew when the mortars were hitting, I could hear people screaming and stuff like that. And then it didn't last long. And then we started hearing corpsman. And then you hear, Vegas hit. So that's how I'd learn stuff. And we didn't rush over there to look at anybody like that. We had to set up the perimeter and stuff like that. And then they brought the choppers in, and we saw them putting the wounded and the dead on the choppers. But, you know, it wasn't like I watched him die or anything. He was just, you know, a few feet away from me, I guess. And so that's the way I saw it. That's the way it was. You know, you just hear stuff like that. Corpsman, Vegas hit. And that just scared the hell out of you. And then we had to move from there to the LZ after we medevac him and the wounded out.
Now, you're there in country, in combat, very, very early on.
Yes, very early.
Did you have any sort of sense that we don't really know what we're getting ourselves into? We've been through all
this. No, I didn't think like that, but I knew that when we went in there with these two battalions to guard that airbase, and I think it was Stars and Stripes that we got. And I noticed that there's a whole lot of other guys coming in real quickly. You know, pretty soon they bring in the army. And, you know, it would go up to 35,000, 50,000 troops in. And I just remember saying, there's a lot of us over here now. Or no, I didn't have any long-range picture or anything like that. I mean, I cannot. It's just, you know, what was going on today. That was all we worried about.
Right.
And that's just day-to-day. And we didn't. And nobody talked about that. You know, like, well, what are we getting into? I think these kids in Iraq and Afghanistan know more about the situation than what we did. Mm-hmm. I can see them talking about it more than we did, but we didn't. We didn't talk about it at all.
Well, I would
the only thing, and we didn't know when we were coming out either. Like later on, because they went to the rotation system, you know, you go in, you know what day you were coming out. When we were, we knew that we had a, I believe it was 14 months overseas. But we'd already been on Okinawa for a while before we went to Vietnam. And then what we were worried about while we were in country is, are we going to have to do 14 months in Vietnam, or are they going to count this as part of our overseas? And what they did is they counted as part of the overseas. That's why we left in September. I was only there 9 months compared to the other guys.
Okay.
But when we left, we thought we were going to go back to Pendleton and get replacements and come right back over. And that's what they had planned for us. And we learned this by a guy named Roger Warren, who's like the battalion historian. And between, actually, we went from Vietnam to Okinawa, from Okinawa back to the States. And on the way back to the States, they changed that. And that's when I went to 2nd Marine Division, and some stayed in 1st Division. A few guys went back. We had a few guys extend in Vietnam, which we tried to talk them out of that. When it was getting close to time we was going to come home, they said that you could extend for 6 months. And if I remember correctly, they said they're not going to send you to a grunt unit. And the reason these guys were doing it was because they were trying to calculate your chance of survival. If it's a 14-month tour, and that's what I remember, whether it was a year or not, I remember it being 14. If they could do 6 months added to the 14 they already had, and then there was a rumor, I don't know if it was true or not, that you had to be in the States 6 months before they could ship you back. So they would tack it 6 months on, 6 months in the States, and if they didn't have enough time left in the Corps to come back, it was better to extend 6 months then come back for 14. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see.
And we told them, don't do it, and they did it. And some of my best friends got killed doing that. They put them right back in a grunt unit. But anyway, some of those stayed over there. A few guys went back, and I did, and I went 2nd Division. And then I went to the drill field, and that's where I stayed till I got out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let me take you back here to Vietnam early in your assignment. You mentioned these operations that you would go on, these search and destroy. I assume you're probably setting up ambushes here or there as well. Can you take me on what would be a typical search and destroy or a typical ambush that you might have been involved in?
Well, normally, these things were very typical. At least they seem to be. That the night before, if I remember right, the lieutenant would call the squad leaders up because I was his radio operator. I'm right there with the lieutenant. Carried a PRC-10 and an M14. The lieutenant made me carry an M14 rather than a 45. And so he would brief the squad leaders, and he'd have a map, and I didn't pay any attention to it because it didn't matter whether I wanted to go or it didn't matter at all. Then he would tell them that we're going to get up at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock, and we're going to get into 6x's and going to take us down to the LZ. And then we'd leave, you know, just about daylight. And then he would put on the map, he'd say, this is where we're going to land here, you know, near some village or something like that. And then we'd start moving, and he'd name the villages. We're going to search these villages, and we're moving all the time like that. And then as soon as it started getting dark, we would move in and set an ambush. And the way you did that, and we, you know, we practiced all this. We were good. We were very good. Is when you're getting ready to set an ambush, you stop because you're not going to move into the ambush area until it's dark. Nobody's going to see you go in there. So we'd stop nearby, and like I said, we'd done this in training. We knew exactly what to do. And the lieutenant might say, "When we go in, I want 1st, 2nd, and 3rd squad like that." And then as it started really getting dark, then you would knock your safeties off, and you go in single file. And then if it's going to be along a creek or something like that, then the first Marine there, it may have been a squad leader or something, then he would stop and just turn to the left to look at where the killing zone is going to be. And everybody just stop and lay down. Nobody ever say a word. And then that would be the killing zone down in that area there. You already knew beforehand who was going to take first watch and who was going to sleep. You never say a word. And so, you know, you'd done that while you were smoking to get ready to go in there and everything. And I don't remember, it may have been 2-hour watches or something. And so while you were sleeping, when it was your turn, then he would just put his hand on your shoulder, and you'd wake up, and you knew what it was for, and he'd go to sleep, and then you'd do that like that. And you spring an ambush. If you're lucky enough and Charlie's coming through, depending on which way he's coming, then if he's coming, say, from left or right, then you let him get all the way down, and the last Marine on the right's the one that's going to trigger the ambush. You want as many of them into the killing zone as you can get in there. And in many cases, that might be an M60 man or something like that. Depending on the terrain, it might be like an L, where there'd be an M60 down there. And although I wasn't on the ambush, I was told that the M60 guy on that particular ambush, he went into the VC, were so close to him that when he killed the first one, he fell right over in his M60. And then when they came in, they would just trigger the ambush like that. And you'd just fire for a few seconds. It didn't take long. And do a quick search of the bodies maybe and then get out of there. Because once you did an ambush, you wanted to get out of there.
Right.
And then go somewhere else. Most of the time, we didn't hit anybody. Nobody came in their ambushes. I don't know if they knew what the ambush area was, and they avoided them, which would have been smart. You know, it's a trail, it's a ford of a river or something like that. So we didn't ambush them many times. We got in more firefights, but I wouldn't say they ambushed us, but they normally initiated the firefights that we were in. But now, we did catch them a few times, but most of the time they initiated the firefight. I don't feel like we ran. I don't know what it was, but, you know, they'd open up on us, and we'd just start returning fire.
No, just be say on just a kind of a...
Yeah, I don't know if they ran. I don't know. I didn't think that we'd walked in an ambush or what, or whether we ran into each other. But, yeah, they would initiate the fire, and then we'd return it. That's the way I remember most of them, like that.
What kind of characteristics would you give to the Viet Cong enemy? What kind of
perception
did you have?
Yeah, we went out one morning, and it was one of these VC vills. They knew they were VC there. And so my platoon, I don't think it was a company, I think it was a platoon. We went out there, got lost. That's so dark. We got lost. Somehow we made it to the vill, and we surrounded it. Now, of course, when you surround it, you got to wait till they get outside that circle. You're going to kill your own people. And then at daylight, they send a fire team or a squad through to try to flush the VC out of the vill. And I remember one of them, he took off, and we're not going to fire till he breaks the circle because we don't want to hit one of our own people. And we were sitting there just kind of drinking sea ration coffee, and we saw this guy running, and they waited, they broke the circle. This guy with the M60 just stood up and just shot him. I remember the guts just going everywhere, you know, and he went down. And then there may have been another one, because a little bit later on that day, we had to shift our lines a little bit for some reason. And one of the Marines in my platoon, I don't remember who it was, all of a sudden he just screamed. And we ran over there, a couple of guys, and he was literally scared to death, holding an M14 on this VC. He'd sat down next to him. He sat down next to this guy. He was in a little jungle area, someplace where there's a lot of foliage, and he didn't know the guy was there. That guy was holding his guts in with both hands. And maybe that one that got the M60 guy got. He was literally holding his guts in with both hands. Didn't make a sound. That's why my Marine buddy didn't know he was there. He didn't see him. And then finally, he just moaned. And I think what he decided to do is he's going to go and try to give up. And my buddy was so scared because we said, why didn't you just kill him? I was so scared I couldn't pull the trigger. It had the safety on. And that guy was tough. And I feel sorry for the guy. I'm sure that the South Vietnamese killed him. But he sat there just for some time without making a sound, holding his damn guts in like that.
Wow.
Isn't that something?
That's, like you say, that's tough.
That's tough. That is tough. And they could chew hard, you know, and he didn't chew hard or anything. And I don't know why. And I don't know why he didn't. You know, who knows why he didn't kill my buddy or anything. But I think he decided that he was sitting there trying to decide whether he's going to kill the guy, die, or just go in and take his chances and surrender. And I think that's when he moaned, because he knew then the guy was going to see him.
What would you say about their tactics, the way they were fighting you in the jungle?
Oh, I think they were good. Yeah.
What sort of things would they do?
Well, like I say, most of the time, we just had the ambushes and stuff. I learned more about their tactics when I started reading some books about them, after, you know, long after the war and stuff like that. They were tough. You couldn't see them. They dragged themselves off. The wounded would drag themselves off. They didn't, you know, find it. The body counts. I sent up there to Kelly just for the heck of it. We had a little, I've forgotten, we had a little battalion newsletter, and there's only one copy of it. And I believe it or not, it was the first one that came out. And it's got some funny stuff in there, you know, about, you know, monsoons and the rain and all the gear that washed out of your foxhole and stuff. But I also had the list of the confirmed kills at that time, you know, company by company and stuff like that. Well, our confirmed kills had to be confirmed. You know, later on that got to be, you know, body count got to be a joke and stuff. But our confirmed kills had to be confirmed. They had to be dead right there. And there were those guys that you'd hit them and you never found their bodies. You know, they found a hole to drag themselves off into and die somewhere. And the reason I think they're doing that is it's demoralizing. You know, if you lost some people and you didn't have anything to pay, you know, show for it or something. But I knew they were tough. But, yeah, don't give me, you know, I wasn't doing a whole lot of thinking about this. I knew that, you know, we'd walk into an area, like I say, they would initiate a firefight. Most of the time we didn't see them. We're just firing back wherever the fire's coming from. Very rarely did we actually see them in a firefight. Just a few times. The ones I remember seeing were when we were up on this god-awful hill. And if I remember correctly, the hill was supposedly so high it was just covered with triple canopy jungle that the choppers couldn't get up on top of it. Now, there's no LZ up there or something, so we landed close, I guess, to the base, and we started up. And we were in this, going on this trail, and we came to a place that had two poles over the trail and a sea ration carton, a piece of a sea ration carton. We knew what that was. And written in broken English was VC Country. We kill all who enter, and a skull and crossbones drawn on that thing. And we walked through that thing, and, it, you know, we felt like, yeah, these people are serious. And that's the only ones I saw were in those the firefights there like that. Most of the time, if I saw one, it would be like maybe in the Ville off 100 yards or something like that. That's the type of firefights we were in. And so a lot of times we didn't have any bodies to show for it because they'd pull them off or something like that. That's most of the firefights. And like I say, we weren't thinking about their strategy or anything like that.
Sure.
They're firing at us, and we're firing back.
Now, you were the RTO. You're following the, I guess, would be the lieutenant of the particular platoon.
Yes, yeah.
Now, once you had set up an ambush, once a firefight would commence, what would you do? You're not on point.
I'd fire. Yeah. Anytime there's a firefight, I'd fire.
Okay. You're dropping down. You're firing your employees.
Yes. Yeah. And all that I would do is, you know, during firefighting, unless somebody called me, you know, Delta Company, the company commander called me, I didn't have to do anything with the radio. Mm-hmm. And unless the lieutenant wanted me to communicate traffic or something. So most of the time, I just don't stand by just in case somebody called me. I didn't do a lot of communicating. Mm-hmm. If it depends on, you know, like at that time, I was in 3rd Platoon, so that's Delta 3. And so they called Delta 3, and that's the 3, Delta, this is 3. And they want to talk to the lieutenant, they request 3 actual. So I tell the lieutenant they want to talk to him. But most of the time, I would just relay a message to the lieutenant, something like that. I didn't do a lot of communicating. I just had to carry it all the time in case I needed to.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And sometimes squads would have PRC 10s. Mm-hmm. I mean, 6s, which people call walkie-talkies. Mm-hmm. Not all the time. And then I had to communicate with them, too. You know, like, first squad, you need to move faster or something like that.
Right, a little coordination.
Yeah, I didn't do a lot of talking on it. I just had to be able, ready to in case I needed to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, what sort of things would you carry with you out in the field?
I'd tell you exactly what I carry. Okay. Sometimes if we were going out specifically to ambush, we might not wear helmets, but most of the time we did. So you got your helmet. I got the PRC 10. It's on a pack board. Got one battery in it. It's a pretty large battery. 2 or maybe 3 other extra batteries, because that battery may or may not last. 140 rounds of M14 ammunition on my belt, two canteens, a first aid kit, a bayonet, and my K-bar, and then had the M14, C rations. When you're getting ready to go out, they would bring the squad leaders would bring the C rations over, and in the Marines, there are 14 guys to a squad, although we didn't have that many. We were under strength. The C rations are set up to feed 14 people. And so they just bring up a box that would have 14. A squad leader bring a box with 14 C rations. We call them C rats. We have only 9 guys in the squad, and you got to pick. Nobody that I remember carried any extra. We were very seldom hungry because it was just too hot over there. And we didn't carry, again, as I read, anything that you didn't absolutely need. And we didn't carry them in these little boxes. We'd take them out. And we had a thing called the heavy. It's like your main meal. That'd be one can. And you'd put that in your pocket. And you might have a dessert. If you were lucky enough to get peaches, you'd put that in your pocket. And you'd have a plastic spoon. And you'd put that up in your shirt or something. The C ration can opener, they came with each one of those. Eventually, everybody had his own, and we'd wear them on our dog tags, open those sea rations and everything. And if I remember correctly, if we were going to be out, we wouldn't carry maybe more than one or two meals a day. We didn't carry a lot of that stuff. That's one reason we lost so much weight. That's the way we get our sea rations. So that's what I'd carry, a few sea rations, the two canteens, the ammunition, and sometimes the lieutenant would have me carry his map, which I thought was awfully cheap of him because he was just carrying a 45, but I couldn't say anything. And I liked my lieutenant. Don't get me wrong. I thought, my God, can't you carry the map? It's just a little bitty thing, you know. Now, are you familiar with the way the infantry in the Marine Corps was set up? When a platoon, you know, you got three rifle platoons and then a weapons platoon in a company.
Right.
Okay, that's what we were. Okay. And I was in a rifle platoon. And most of the time we'd leave, we'd take one squad of weapons with us. And you probably know how that works. Then. Three squads to platoon, so first squad weapons would go with first platoon, second squad weapons go second platoon, third squad weapons would go with third platoon. And weapons, of course, were M60s and 3.5 rocket launchers. They were the weapons people. But that's what I would carry out on patrol. They wouldn't let you take letters. You didn't take letters or anything like that. You know, I've heard about people taping the dog tags. I don't remember taping them. I don't know if we did or not. I don't remember. Because the way the dog tags fit down in my shirt, they didn't rattle anyway. They weren't touching each other. And we sweated so much, it's like they stick to you. And so I don't remember that anybody said tape them up or anything. I don't remember that. We didn't have any problems with the thing. And then you had to carry at all times this little thing that's in a, oh, how they seal this stuff in plastic. And it was our Geneva Convention card. Had to carry that in your pocket in case you got captured.
What did you think about that Geneva Convention card?
It's a joke. We knew that it wasn't going to do any good, but we had to carry it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I had it for years, and I've lost it. And I guess it was the heat, but it looks like that plastic, you know how you save a letter? What's the word for it when you seal it in this plastic? The plastic looked like it'd been melted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could read it, but it was shriveled up and everything. And that had to be just from the heat and everything in Vietnam. But I never put it next to heat. But it was definitely anything but new. Yeah, I wish I'd have kept that. I mean, I didn't. I accidentally lost it. I don't know where it is.
You've mentioned this a couple times. You've talked about the heat. And of course, this is obviously a tropical environment, but can you explain to me, in your words, what it was like, the weather, the terrain? You got an awful lot of weight on you, let alone being in a combat situation.
Yeah.
What was the environment like on you and your mindset?
Oh, it's just hotter than hell, and I'm surprised we didn't have people die from heat stroke and stuff. And there was, I don't know, I wouldn't say you get used to it, but it's just the way it was just there. And I was with I've been divorced twice to my second wife. She taught up here, and we walking somewhere in the summer, and she said, it's hot. And I said, you're bitching. I mean, how did I put it? I said, you know the difference between bitching and complaining? She said, no. I said, complaining is when you say you're hot. Bitching is when you say it's hot. Because we bitched in Vietnam. And it was blankety blank hot. But nobody ever said, I'm hot. Like, you know, we're not. And that's when I realized there's a difference between bitching and complaining. Nobody complained. We just bitched all the time. And the sweat, oh, my gosh, in your eyes and all that kind of stuff. You know, I'm sure it was much worse than I don't think about that a whole lot. In your shirt, my gosh, you just like somebody poured water all over you. And there was no place to get cool. If you got cool, it'd be because it rained and it was nighttime or something. It might be a little chilly or something like that. And I don't know why we didn't have people die from the heat stroke and all. I don't remember a lot of breaks. Like, you know, you guys need a break. Maybe they did, but I don't remember them. I remember we was going up this hill, and this in my platoon, in my company, it seemed like the little guys carried the big weapons, like the M60s and everything. Somebody says it's because they make smaller targets. And the M60 people are fanatic about that weapon. They just would not let anybody else touch that damn weapon. And I remember we was going up a hill, and this young Marine carried that M60 on his shoulder, and I swear to God, I thought he was going to pass out. And this other Marine said, you want me to hump your 60 for you? And I thought that 60 guy was going to kill him. Get out of here. I got to touch this damn thing. I'd die before I let you touch one of these things. And I never will forget that.
Why do you think that was? Why the loyalty?
I don't know. It was their gun, and by God, in fact, when we were mounting out to go to Vietnam, I asked the gunner, M60 guy, I said, could I get a picture of me holding that M60? He said, no. He said, can you send it to your girlfriend and tell her you're a big bag machine gunner, aren't you? I said, no, I just want to hold a damn M60. Well, they finally let me do it. Under the condition, they stood on each side of me in case I screwed it up somewhere. They didn't know if I knew how to hold a damn M60, so they're standing there to make sure I didn't hurt their little baby or anything. But, yeah, they were proud of being M60 guys. But, yeah, they wouldn't let you touch it. That was their damn gun. And they'd die before they let somebody else hump it for them. But it's hard to explain. It's just when I think about this today, as hot as it is now, you know, all the heat warnings and all, and it just makes me laugh because of what we went through over there. And I'm not saying they shouldn't do it, but then I think about what we did and the physical part of it. You know, take away the booby traps and all that stuff. Just doing the physical part of it, it's just unbelievable what we did. Because we were out in that heat 24/7. Nobody felt sorry for you because we was all into the same damn thing. Run out of water quick. Water discipline's a pull. You got two canteens in the heat that seems like it's over 100 degrees with all that humidity, and you're moving all the time. And I tell you what, those two canteens were gone. That one, when we went up that base camp, that's the thirstiest I've ever been. We ran out of water quickly. And they don't just bring you water and ammunition just because you ran out. They don't do that. But that water discipline was a joke. And so most of the time we're thirsty. And I don't remember, we ran out early that day. And we were up high up on the mountain where there's no water up there. And we moved all night because when we went through that VC base camp, we didn't know where the rest of them were. We estimated there were hundreds of those guys, and they must have been out on a raid somewhere. That's why I say if they'd been there, I wouldn't have been here. And so the lieutenant didn't want us to stop. And then we ambushed another group of them, I guess rear guards, sitting around eating that rice just after we left that place. So we're trying to get the hell out of there. And we never stopped. And in the night, we couldn't see in front of you. And I told my students, I said, that's when I realized that you can go to sleep walking. But I would start dreaming, and I'd wake up when I hit that damn floor of that jungle. And I could hear these other Marines dropping like that, too. And you know, and we just moved all that night, and then sometime the next day we came to the first water, and I got a picture. I have a little display of not only Vietnam but Civil War stuff, and by these rooms here, and it's this Marine. You can see that jungle right next to him, and he's got his canteen in that water, and he's looking right down that river. He's not looking to that water or anything. That's the first water we got, And I remember seeing a snake when I was spending my canteen swim by, and I just said, if you don't bother me, it ain't going to bother you. And that was the biggest problem with being thirsty all the time, on the heat, just all the time.
Well, how do you deal with that? You've only got two canteens. You're in this incredible heat with all this work and all this weight.
I don't know. that's the longest I think we went without water. That's the longest we went without water. I've got a picture over here of a friend of mine just where he got killed. It's up on the wall, up on my wall. It's framed, and it's got his name from the wall underneath it. Mm-hmm. And he's a 3.5 guy. He's got their ammo on his backpack. And what they're doing is they're at this bill, this hooch, and it looks like they're dumping water. They're getting water out of one of the containers, the Vietnamese containers. So I'm sure we get some of that, but you put those tablets in to purify it and everything.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, I don't know how we did it. Now, when we were going to be out for 3 days, they bring water out there. You weren't out the whole time. But you had certain times that you had to be in an LZ to get resupplied with water and ammo.
Right.
And so it wasn't like, well, go ahead and drink it up. It's about an hour. We'll get more water or anything. You just had to watch it, I guess. And if you ran out, you ran out. Because I don't think anybody gave you a sip of their water. I don't remember that.
I'd be surprised.
I just don't. You know, we may love each other, but you ain't getting this damn water. At least I don't remember that. And, of course, somebody got wounded. That was different. But,
right.
You know, these are things that don't make any sense, you know. And of course, if you drink too much, it hurts your stomach. But, yeah, you only had two canteens of water until you got resupplied. And I don't remember. It might be that afternoon, but I guarantee you it wasn't just whenever you wanted it. That's what the lieutenant would explain. We had to leave a firefight once because we couldn't miss the drop at the LZ. It was not anything serious, but it was a bill. And they were firing at us, and we were pretty good ways off. We had to break it off because we had to get to the LZ, because if you're not at the LZ, they don't wait on you. And we had to pick up ammo and water there. And that was all part of these patrols and everything, that you were scheduled to be at a certain LZ at a certain time, and you better be there. Well, they didn't wait on you.
If you can, tell me about this. Like you say, it wasn't maybe not necessarily an intense fight that y'all were in. But nonetheless, you broke away to meet this LZ. Tell me about that if you can.
Because the way up, see, we didn't have enough choppers for everybody. Yeah. And so when they scheduled, you better be at this LZ for ammo and water, you better be there right then because they're not going to wait on you. And so that one particular time, the lieutenant said, we got to go. We got to get to that LZ or they're not going to be anything there. And then you didn't get any more until the next time you were scheduled.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just too important. Well, if you got delayed with a firefight, that would be a little bit different. But it was serious enough that you better be there. If you wanted ammo and water, you better be there.
Well, what about this firefight that you had to pull back from?
It wasn't anything big. Mm-hmm. Like I say, if I remember, it was maybe 150 yards off, and it was a bill. And I think we were going past it. And some Charlies fired at us. And so we just returned fire. We weren't moving into the bill or anything like that. We just started returning fire. In fact, we got one guy hit, but I can't remember. And we fired at it for a little while, and not a long time, you know, just maybe 3 or 4 minutes. And the lieutenant said, we got to go. We got to move out of here. So we didn't go to the bill. We just moved out. And I think I waved goodbye, you know, and something like that. And we had to break it off to go to the LZ.
Okay.
I distinctly remember that. Because like I say, that when those choppers were, you better be there or you don't get the food or the water. And it would be like missing a bus, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You got to wait till the next one comes. Of course, it would be somewhere else. But that's what I remember. And like I say, I wasn't taking notes on all this stuff.
Sure.
And but I do distinctly remember breaking off that firefight because we had to get to that LZ.
Okay. Now you've talked about the heat. You've talked about the lack of water. What about things like the geography? What about things like the foliage you came across? How was this affecting you as you were trying to hump your way through?
Oh my God! The jungle was thick as anything you've ever seen. You could not see in front of you. I mean, people say you couldn't see a foot in some cases. You couldn't see the Marine in front of you. And you know, these people that exercise like climbing steps, you're doing that all the time. You're climbing, and in the jungles, they had what we call the wait-a-minute vines that would get all over you.
Mm-hmm.
It took a lot of energy just to go anywhere in that jungle. out in the rice paddies, that was easier to be walking on the dikes most of the time. It would just be that he'd be like walking out in the fields here. The hills and the mountains were the worst terrain. Cause, I mean, that's, anybody goes mountain climbing, and it's well, not like mountain climbing. But you're going up an incline, and it's not made to be going up and stuff like that, carrying all that stuff. One of my favorite scenes in the movie Platoon, if you remember that first one, they went out and they're trying to get up that hill, mm-hmm. and they're helping each other come up. That's what I remember, stuff like that. Not quite as bad as that, but that was more realistic than anything I've seen. You know, a guy was got to drop down and maybe, well, I don't think we slid any, but it was just, we'd be walking like that all the time. There was no easy walking unless it was in the rice paddies or something, and not in the paddy, but on the dike. That would be the easiest walking. And I don't remember if we were in jungles more. I don't remember. I know we were in a lot of jungles and went in a lot of rice paddies. Sometimes we were in both at the same time, like in that time we got mortared. We were coming out of the jungle and got out to the paddies there, and that's when they hit us. The terrain was just tough. I found out that I Corps was where we were, because the Roman numeral for one, you know.
Right.
That was the roughest terrain in Vietnam. I didn't know that until I was reading years later. Westmoreland, one of the Marines up there. Because it was tough terrain. Mainly it was the jungles and the mountains and stuff like that. And I know there were some tough places elsewhere, but I didn't see them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned this time where you're coming out of this, out of these hills, out of this jungle, into more of a flat kind of...
In the opening area, yeah.
Yeah, in an opening, and you're getting mortared. Can you take me through that time?
Well, we're just coming out, and believe it or not, we killed a couple of BC, and we were supposed to bring this Viet Cong back. We had him tied on a damn pole. And the reason was, it wasn't to confirm the kill. I handed handset to the lieutenant or something. This is what we were told. But they had some Vietnamese down somewhere, and they're going to look at him and try to see if he was a local VC or he was from the north or something. But we had him tied on there like a damn deer. And we were coming out of the jungle and just got into the clearing when we heard those pops. And I sure thought I was doing my turn of carrying that guy. I was on the back. I know I took my turn because the dead VC, one of his legs, I forget which one it was, but just barely hanging, just by a little bit of skin. And while we were walking, he was bouncing up and down, and I thought, if that leg breaks, it's going to hit me right in the damn face. And then when we heard the pops, I remember, I think I know who was on the other front of that pole, and we threw him one way, and that's when we jumped to the ground. And it was like I told you, they mortared us about, maybe just a minute or so. And that's when Vega got hit, got killed. Vega, that's another Marine, he got wounded up in another place. That's when Fernandez got killed and a couple of other people. And we didn't pick, it just happened real quick like that. And it was scary because, like I say, you're completely helpless with those mortars coming in on top of you like that.
Well, what do you guys do in response to this?
We fired back, but we didn't do it right away. Mm-hmm. Most of the time we just hit the ground, you know, and then we did return fire. It was hard to tell. We couldn't tell from the pops exactly where they were. It was like in an area where you hear sound, but you can't tell what direction it came from. Mm-hmm. It was like that. But we saw some hills that we thought maybe that's where they were, so we returned some fire, called in the medevacs, and then after they loaded the dead and the wounded, then we still had to get to the LZ. And I remember my radio had gone out. And I don't know why, but I asked the lieutenant if I could walk point. And I guess because I'd seen too many movies. And he ended up, because my radio was gone. I don't remember if I was out of batteries or what. There's just no communication. And he said, okay, but he said, watch it because I'm sure they're going to ambush us before we get to the LZ. And I wish he hadn't said that. I never walked point again after that.
What was walking point like for you?
It was scary. Oh, my God. If he hadn't said that, I think it'd been all right. Because I had to watch out for them. And what am I looking for? You're moving and all that. The lieutenant was pretty close to me, so it wasn't like I'd get lost. You know, he'd say go more left or something like that. But it was just a responsibility and all that. And that's all it was for me. And I never asked to walk point again. I thought it was some big, bad, neat thing you could do. And It wasn't, not as far as I was concerned.
Now, were you guys ambushed while you were on
the road? No, we weren't. But, we thought we might be.
Mm-hmm.
And, just that suggestion reminded me that we could. No, we weren't. Mm-hmm. So it turned out to be okay, but I didn't want point anymore after that.
You mentioned
we didn't have one guy that liked to walk point. We called him, nicknamed Point Man. And at a reunion, I asked him why. He said because he couldn't trust anybody else. So that's why he always liked to walk point. And the way you did it, you probably have interviewed others and know that there's really, in my tune, there's nothing random. First squad, well, which fire team? Third fire team, second fire team, first fire team. And so you rotate the point every now and then. And so when I say he liked to walk the point, it depends on whether his platoon or his squad would be in that position. It wasn't like he did it every day. But he seemed, we called him Point Man to this day.
Now,
I only did it once, and I didn't care for it.
I can't understand why.
No, I didn't care for it.
During this episode where you were being hit by these mortars, how do you know when it's okay to get up? How do you know when it's okay to call in the medevac?
Well, you called it in anyway. Now, I didn't call it in. We may have been on a company because I didn't call in the medevac, mm-hmm. although I was a radio operator. It may have been a company size. That's been the only reason I wouldn't have done it. Once the mortar stopped, that's when we started calling them in. And like I say, they could have opened up on us again, too, but they just didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. May have packed up.
There may have been some firing. I don't know if any were firing where the mortars were coming in, but I think everybody was just down on the ground. And then afterwards, we were trying to figure out where they were. And that's why I remember we couldn't really tell, but there was an area that we thought they were. So there's some guys just put some fire up there.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't much we could do.
We
thought we knew where they were, and I know some guys, I don't know if we put any mortars up there, but I know some of them fired up there, but there wasn't a whole lot we could do. We figured they'd bugged out by then. We figured they had a few rounds, they fired them at us and bugged out.
Yeah, good.
That's what we figured.
Oftentimes the way they
worked
is my understanding.
Uh-huh. Yep.
You mentioned a little while ago, you were talking about the M60 and the loyalty that your buddies mm-hmm. had, the guys in your squad had for the M60.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about the weapons that you would have in your platoon, the ones you liked, the ones you didn't like, what you
okay.
would like to have had? Tell me about the weapons.
Well, the weapons we had. Now, we were still using M14s,
mm-hmm.
and we're very fortunate. It was a good weapon.
That's always the case. People who use the M14 like them. Why did you like the M14?
It never misfired. It never jammed on you. It would knock a man down. It was a killing weapon. There was some BC that we killed with them. And as I remember, it was like you took a meat cleaver and just took chunks of the guy off. It wasn't like the movies. I've never seen anything like that. But the main thing is that it never jammed on us. It never misfired, and it would kill a man. And I mean, it was a deadly, deadly round. You didn't have to. We kept it as clean as you could. But in the infantry, you can't keep it clean, especially out in the bush like that. And so the squad, we weren't ever what we call TO, table of organization, 14 to a squad. We never had that. But in each squad, in a platoon, in a rifle platoon, first, second, third, I was third platoon, you had three rifle squads, supposedly 14 each. You had a squad leader, you carried an M14. Next to him is a grenadier, an M79, a grenade launcher. And I thought that was neat. And then you had three fire teams. First, second, and third. Fire team would have the fire team leader with an M14 automatic rifle. That's the M14 on automatic. He carries more ammo. He's the only one who's got it on aim. And then a scout or assistant AR man and a scout. And you had three fire teams to a squad. So we had three automatic rifles for each squad. That's our rifle platoon. And then the weapons was M60s and 3.5s, which people call for the bazooka. That was the weapons. People say, well, how come all of y'all didn't want automatics? Well, first off, they're not going to let you do that. You can't change them. I didn't use an M16. I don't know if they could change them from semi-automatic to automatic. We couldn't. You had to go to an armor. But we didn't do that because you'd run out of ammunition. We had to have fire discipline. And I don't remember anyone that didn't have an automatic M14 that wanted it on automatic. I mean, just pulling the trigger was fast enough for us.
Right.
But, yeah, we had, except the M60s and everything, our rifles were all M14s, except the ones that were on automatic. the three ARs in each squad.
Did you eventually get the M16?
Oh, yeah, that was in the weapons. No. Oh, no, sir. We never did.
Okay, you never did.
I'm glad. I think just judging from some film and stuff that I've seen and some of the pictures, it must have been about November or December of 66 by the time the Marines started getting those M16s. Because I had a friend in college that was in a place called the Rock Pile over there. And he got wounded three times. He got, oh, man, all messed up. And he was still using M14s. I've got a Life magazine. And it has some pictures from it. It's a 1966. It's the one that's got the wounded black Marine on the cover and everything. I'm sure you've got it there.
Yes.
And those are M14s. And so it had been some time after that.
Okay.
But I never saw an M14. I'm an M16. Never used one.
You also mentioned a moment ago, you said something about running into booby traps on one of these patrols.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of booby traps did you encounter?
Oh, my gosh. Some of them were bouncing Bettys. Had a friend killed. In fact, the guy whose picture's up on the wall, he was killed by that. And some type of explosive, and he accidentally hit him. But what had happened is there was a firefight, and he was a 3.5 man, and the lieutenant thought they saw a target. And he called that fire team up. And while he was jogging up there, hit an empty C ration can, which was the trigger for that bouncing Betty. And it came up about waist high and just exploded. And that was one of the type of them. They were punji traps. That didn't bother us too much, believe it or not. We'd find some of them. Some of them were pretty large, but I don't remember anybody in my platoon that ever fell in one of them or anything like that. Some of them were just hand grenades, where you would have a wire and pull the pin and trip it. They'd have the pin out and then have the spoon, have it wedged in between some vines or something like that. And that's the most of the ones we ran into. Yeah.
Okay.
We were pretty lucky, though. We didn't have a lot of that. We had some, but not much. Rose got killed by one. And again, this is just in my platoon. You know, guys are getting hit in the other stuff, but I didn't see them. And the other companies and stuff like that.
As you're moving through on one of these sweeps, one of these search and destroy missions, you mentioned occasionally that you will come across a village, you'll come across a group of huts of these Vietnamese hooches. Take me through the process by which your fire team, which your squad, which your platoon would work its way through or to or and through one of these villages.
Yeah. The way we'd go through them, and again, because I was radio operator, I don't remember if guys were told to go in and search them. A lot of times we were just moving through the veil to go somewhere. And I remember that we knew whether there's VC in the area or not, because if you went into the veil and they came out and they're laughing and the kids are asking for cigarettes or candy and stuff like that, and they're saying Marine number one, VC number 10, there's no Charlies around there. But when you go in a veil and they don't come out, and they stay in those hooches, and they don't come out, then VC around there somewhere. We didn't do any me lies or anything like that. Now, we gotten fire from one of them. That'd been a different story. But just going through a bill like that. There was one, we went through one like that, and we got hit on the other side. Now, whether they knew there were Charlies over there or not, I don't know. At least I don't remember whether they were inside. They may have been inside, and we got hit on the other side. But that's what we did, and if anybody was going through the search of the thing, it would have been the squads, and I wasn't doing that. And I don't remember guys in my platoon going into the hooches and pulling things out and anything like that.
We were just
moving through the bill. I don't recall actually searching it. We were just searching for Charlie. We weren't searching the hooches or anything.
Did you ever suspect that the bills would be friendly to the VC?
We knew even when they were being friendly to us, just to show. We figured they were VC. Like I say, we didn't waste them or anything like that.
When they
came out and said Marine number one and all, we just laugh at them, you know, dinky Dow and all that kind of stuff. We didn't think about it a lot, but we pretty well knew they weren't on it. They could care less about us.
Well, you say you didn't think about it much, but I would have to think that as you approach a village and you strongly suspect that it is a very VC-friendly village or just flat out a VC village.
Yeah.
You would have to, I would think, anyway, consider that the children there could be dangerous to you.
Oh, yeah.
That the mm-hmm. women and the old men could be dangerous
yeah.
to you. How do you handle a situation like that in your mind?
Well, the way we did it is if they weren't trying to kill you, we just left them alone. And like I say, they did. And you watch them. I mean, it wasn't like you didn't watch them or anything like that, because we knew, you know, they had a hand grenade or something like that. You know, it's kind of hard to explain. You know, they were out there being friendly. We didn't bother them. If they weren't out there, they were in the hooches, and we didn't go looking for them or anything like that. I know in the firefights, we didn't care. We didn't care whether it was, if they were in a firefight, anybody would fire at the VC. We didn't think about what they call collateral damage. We didn't think about that. If they were firing at us, we'd kill them all.
Okay.
But if they weren't firing at us, we didn't do it. And I don't remember thinking, you know, a whole lot about whether they, I pretty well felt they weren't on our side or anything, but then we were told, you know, yeah, they are. So I didn't think a lot about it. If they weren't trying to hurt us, we didn't bother them.
Okay.
Yeah.
What kind of interaction did you have with Vietnamese?
Very little. They come out, and even those kids would bum a smoke off of you. I say candy. We didn't have any candy. Chocolate would have melted over there. We may get them, and I can't see them giving, maybe somebody gave them a C ration or something. Mainly what they wanted was cigarettes. And they come up, you know, in Marine number 1, VC number 10, and stuff like that. We just, yeah, dink you down. And, yeah, dink you down, you know, stuff like that. I don't remember, and people say, I bet you hate rice. I never ate any of that food. I didn't eat any rice or anything. I wasn't about to do that. I ate C rations. Because in one of those bills, man, you know, filthy. My God, they were filthy. I know we saw them picking lice out of hair and eating it, stuff like that. The stink. I don't know what they're eating, but the last thing I want to do is eat anything they had in those pots. Yeah. But it's amazing. People say, I bet you'd like that. I guess they thought we went to Vietnamese restaurants or something. You know, they're shocked that you didn't eat rice and take in the local cuisine.
No,
we didn't do that.
Yeah, that wasn't certainly wasn't in your mission.
No, it wasn't. Uh-uh. We didn't eat any of that junk. Uh-uh. No. But, yeah, it's just kind of amazing. And a lot of it, and I think the best way to do it is right now is the only time that you're worried about. This right this second. You didn't think about one hour from now or anything. At least we didn't. You know, if they weren't trying to kill us, we're not going to kill them. And we didn't talk to them a whole lot. At least I don't remember anybody carrying on conversations. Every now and then we'd take an Arvin out for a translator, but we didn't do that very often. And he might ask him something, but I don't. And I'd been with a lieutenant, but there wouldn't have been a whole lot that I remembered. I don't remember a whole lot. We took some VC. I mean, not VC, but Arvin out. Could have been VC. And they had these dogs. I guess German shepherds are supposed to find them where they hid the ammo and all that stuff. And his dog was going crazy, and we found out they didn't feed that poor dog. He was hungry as everything. Every time we came to a little cave or something, he was just going crazy. It turned out to be worthless.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, I will say this. We took a few of the South Vietnamese out with us, and there was just one kid. And we took breaks. I know we did. I mean, it can't be as bad as I thought, you know. And I remember sitting out there, and we're out on a patrol somewhere, and he looked like he was maybe 18 years old. And I guess he knew some English. Not very much, but he knew some English. He's an enlisted man, too. And he found out I was from Texas. My nickname was Tex. Oh, it just thrilled him. And he pulled his wallet out. And he'd been to Da Nang or Saigon and got his picture made riding a stick horse. With his chaps and his cowboy hat and his cowboy shirt. And he looked at me and he showed me that picture and he said, do I look like a real cowboy? And I said, yes, sir, you do. You like a real. And it was the silliest looking thing. It was those old, like those sheep haired chaps and everything.
Right, right.
That's what he had on. He was on a stick horse. And he said, oh, cowboy, this like real cowboy. And that's exactly what a cowboy looks like. That made him feel good.
Oh, I bet you made his day.
Oh, made him feel real good, because I was from Texas and all that kind of stuff. And I asked him, I said, when are you getting out of the Army? he looked at me like I was crazy. He said, I'm not. Mm-hmm. He said, unless I get killed or I get maimed, I'm in here to stay. You know, and I realized we're pretty lucky. We're getting out of there someday. And I felt sorry for the kid. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know how they were treated. Nobody's going to help them. You talk about helping us. They didn't help them at all. They got hurt. But I felt sorry for the little guy. And, you know, I always wonder what happened to the boy. That's one time I do remember him. He had that picture of him. I guess he was in the Nang. He went to a photo studio or something. And Elvis had his hair like Elvis Presley.
The best of American culture.
Oh, yeah, Elvis and cowboys. Yeah, he had those ducktails and everything under his helmet. Oh, right. Yeah, I remember that. Elvis was the man. Yep.
Why don't we stop there for today, Mr. Stroud? This is Kelly Crager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. David Stroud. Today is 15 July 2009. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Stroud is joining me from Kilgore, Texas. Off the record a moment ago, Mr. Stroud, you were talking about a few different issues that you would like to discuss. One had to do with someone in your company winning the Navy Cross. Mm-hmm. Won't you, if you would, please, talk about that a little bit. Explain what you know about that and who this gentleman was.
Okay. I didn't really know him. He was in my battalion. He was in Company A, 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines, and his act was 11 July 1965. His name was Brian J. Guthrie, G-A-U-T-H-I-E-R. And basically, they went out on operation and, I mean, came under intense enemy gunfire. Virtually everyone is wounded. And although he was mortally wounded, he refused evacuation. He gave encouragement for firing, and it was several hours. He finally died from his wounds and everything. And that's the only Marine in my battalion I'm aware of. That's the highest award in the battalion. We had one or two Silver Star recipients, a few Bronze Star recipients, a lot of Purple Hearts and stuff like that, Navy commendations. The other thing I mentioned was killing that BC courier and having his document translated. Mm-hmm. And basically what it said was, tell us how to fight these U.S. Marines. They do not scare. They go anywhere. They have faces like mad dogs. Tell us how to fight these U.S. Marines. And I think that's because our battalion had trained so well that we were really pretty good.
Right.
And Sergeant Colby from Rumor War, he had said that ours was the best battalion he'd ever served with. And he did at least two tours in Vietnam, one before that as an advisor before he joined us, and he also served in the Korean War. And that was basically what I was talking about. And then got off on all these ribbons and everything.
Right.
No, you know, they've gone overboard on those things.
Let me interrupt you for just a moment on each of these things. Now, the Navy Cross winner in this particular firefight, this particular battle, was mm-hmm. your company, was D Company involved in that?
No, uh-uh.
Okay.
That's why I didn't even know about it.
But okay.
He was in our battalion, and it was probably a company exercise or something. Uh-huh. We weren't involved in that.
Okay.
I know we were doing something else, but I don't know what it was. One thing about Rumor War, and you may know this, you know, he left our battalion about March. Mm-hmm. And that's when we really started going out to the bush and everything. It was about when Caputo left our battalion.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Now, did you know him at all?
I think I saw him once. Mm-hmm. He was an officer in Charlie Company. Mm-hmm. And when a unit would go out, we'd have to stretch our lines to cover the gap that they created in the lines. Mm-hmm. And I was radio operator with my lieutenant. And we went over to Charlie Company. And because lieutenants can't talk to us the way they talk to each other.
Right.
You know, it's a whole different thing. I remember going up there with him being his radio operator, and all those platoon commanders from Charlie Company were there. And I know one of them had to be Caputo. And one of them saw me, and I'll tell you this. I'm not making this up. And my lieutenant's name was Yax, Y-A-X. And he asked Lieutenant Yax, he said, I want to trade radio operators with you. And Lieutenant Yak said, why do you want him? And he said, he's got killer eyes. I like to think that was Caputo.
Even if it's not, it makes a good story, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, whoever it was, that's what he said. And my lieutenant said, nope, not going to do that, you know. But that made me feel good even then.
You know, the things that you've talked about here so far briefly today all bring me back to a general point that I think that you might be in good position to make. About the VC's impression of your outfit, of the Marines, of the 1st to the 3rd, and of course you're in D Company.
Uh-huh.
And you talk about, you know, the impression that this officer, whether it's Caputo or not, had of you, and of course, this Navy Cross winner.
Uh-huh.
What was it about your unit that you think made your group so effective as a fighting force? What are the ingredients that made that happen?
I think one was we trained together. I was thinking about this the other day, that after boot camp, I joined that particular unit in, when was it? Oh, it was in the summer, out of 1st Marine Division. Let's say I got out of boot camp in January, February, March, April, May, about June. And we started training there, and then we went over to Okinawa. And we don't go to Vietnam until January. Well, we were training all the time, up in the jungles and everything. We knew what we were doing. And unlike the other units where they have the replacements coming in and all that kind of stuff, we had a camaraderie that was just unbelievable. Unbelievable. And we didn't even know it. And that brotherhood, amazingly, is not that we liked everybody in the unit, but we didn't realize how close we were. We could trust every man in that unit. You never had to worry about him going to sleep on watch. You never had to worry about him covering your back. You could trust every one of those people. And I think that was something maybe a little bit different. I think a lot of our training, and I'll tell you something else, with those killer eyes, which I didn't realize I had. My mama said I had nice eyes. But in my first battalion reunion, I was up there visiting, drinking beer and cracking jokes. And one of the guys in that battalion looked at me and he said, "What are you cracking jokes?" And I said, "Well, I always have." He said, "You never said a funny thing in Vietnam." He said, "I never saw you smile." And I don't believe, I can't think of ever cracking one joke or smiling the whole time we were in Vietnam.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Why do you suppose that was?
I think we'd gotten into a thought of mine where I've told people, you know, we're visiting and stuff. We were as close to being an animal as you could be and be a human. And like when we kill people, it was no more bothersome than killing a bug. It didn't bother anybody. We wanted to kill them. And it was as close to being an animal as you could be. And that's the way it was in Vietnam. And I felt like that about it. We didn't talk about it, but just thinking back, that's just the way it was.
Well, let me ask you to expand on that a little bit. Now, obviously, you're living in the bush. You are facing life and death circumstances all the time. You're with a bunch of other men, which can have
you're just dehumanized. Yep.
What sort of specific examples can you give me about this kind of behavior, this kind of mindset, and what does that do to you as an individual?
Well, you know, I was seeing something on the news yesterday about having problems with these combat veterans committing murder when they come back. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw that. There's also some drugs in there, too, and all of that. And I don't know about it. That didn't bother me. I mean, once I got out of combat, I didn't have any problems. I didn't bring any of that stuff home or anything like that. And I don't know of anyone else in my unit that did. The only one I know that went to prison didn't go to prison for killing anybody. He went to prison for drugs. But there was something about that. I mean, you were in the filth all the time. You were hot. You were sweaty. Only remember taking one shower. And as I say, I don't say only took one. I can only remember taking one. And that wasn't a shower like here. That was in a little makeshift shower that had a bucket. I mean, a pan that had holes in it, and one Marine would pour 5 gallons of water in, and that's what you use to soap up, and another 5 gallons to rinse off. There were no doors or anything on it. But the reason we didn't do it is you're just going to go back and get filthy again. I mean, there was no sense in doing it. You stunk. Everybody stunk. You were filthy all the time. Didn't sleep under a roof. At night, we had tents in the daytime that we could go up there and lounge around, but at night, we were back in our bunkers, or back in our park, or we were on patrol. And you lived out in the rain, you lived out in the heat, and everything. I mean, you were as close to being an animal as you humanly could be. And as far as killing, I did not know one Marine over there, my unit, that was ever bothered by that one little bit. Not one bit. Nobody felt, they just didn't do it. It was just a root. It wasn't even routine. I don't know how to explain it. It was just a non thing that you did.
Seems like it would be just a part of life.
It was, yeah. Better than, and not even, it just, it's hard to explain the attitude that you had. And, And even to this day, I don't know anybody that's ever got bothered by that stuff. But anyway, that's just, we were as close to being an animal as you could be. Now, there'd be some joking and stuff, but it wasn't a whole lot of it. A lot of the joking had to do with killing people, you know, like blowing his damn guts out and stuff like that, you know. But, you know, I didn't think about that, too, until years later about how close to an animal we were. I don't know any other way to describe it. And it was the living conditions and all that. And I don't know. We lived out there so much. That's just the way it was. Yep.
Well, now, this is a little out of our chronology here, but it's something I think is important to mention. You were also talking about the awarding of medals in Vietnam and how you were somewhat disappointed with the way they were apportioned, the way they were awarded. Can you talk about that a little bit? Give me your impressions about that.
Well, at the time, I wasn't, but like I was telling you, that it was more, I think you had to do a little bit more to get a medal at that time when we were over there,
which was
like one Navy Cross and all of that. And the only reason I say that is because as the years went by, I went over to a museum in Longview, and there was a Bronze Star citation for a soldier in the museum, and that's why I read it. And what he got that far was being a company commander for 6 months in tanks, and there, as far as I know, he never even got shot at. Well, that's not what you got Bronze Stars for in 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines. I guarantee you that. And I started seeing what some of these other citations were, and I started thinking, we didn't get anything like that. So it seemed like they got a little bit more generous in handing out the medals and stuff as they went further on. We were told later on that because the casualties did start increasing to try to boost morale, they got more generous with that stuff. But that's about all. I guess that's about all I have to say about that. And I think they've really gone overboard now. I really do.
What do you think that does to the value of?
Oh, that's the thing. It just decreases the value. It's an inflation. How can you appreciate anything if you have them, so many of them? Mm-hmm. And the people that don't know what they represent, mm-hmm. if they were to see a Medal of Honor recipient, I don't think they'd recognize it, especially if he didn't have it around his neck, if he just had a ribbon on. I don't know. It just gives the wrong impression of these guys, and everybody that's in the Army now, and I'm sure the Marine Corps. You know, they get three or four rows of ribbons, by doing one tour or something like that. And I don't know. I just think they've gotten too generous with them. And people in the service that I've talked to, some of them would tell you the same thing, that they'll laugh at what they get those ribbons for now.
Why do you think that came about? You talked about morale, but do you think that was the only thing?
I don't know. I think it's whoever it is that comes up with all these different things. I think they thought that it was going to do some good. I don't know why, but I mean, some of the ribbons that we got retroactive, we got one that we'd been in combat. Well, that's okay. I'm kind of proud of that, but we didn't have that when I was in. That's retroactive. Called the Combat Action Ribbon.
When did you receive that?
Oh, I didn't get that. I got it framed up here. It's about 5 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's not done by the... It's something when they made it, they came up with it. It's retroactive back through Vietnam. And then I had to send a proof of service and that I'd been in combat off to the Commandant. It's a Marine Corps ribbon. Not even a medal. And then they had to look to make sure you've been in combat, and then they awarded it. And it's called the Combat Action. They didn't have that during Vietnam. When I was in the Marines, when I got out, I had the Vietnam Service Medal, Vietnam Campaign Medal, National Defense, and Good Conduct. That's all I had. Now, I've got about three rows of ribbons.
That have come to you since you left.
Yeah, Like one for being a drill instructor, of all things.
Wow.
Yeah. That was unheard of. I got a ribbon for being a drill instructor. I got a Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry for nothing. You tell somebody you got a Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry, they think you're a hero. I didn't do a thing for that. So, you know, it's that type of stuff.
Right.
Yeah. One called the Civic Action. Going out there and helping Vietnamese civilians. Mm-hmm. I don't think we ever helped any Vietnamese civilians.
So your unit wasn't involved in civic
Some of them were, and like in that, the name Four Holder, I think it mentioned somebody down there helping somebody. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's ribbons like that, I don't think, to me, aren't really necessary.
You weren't involved personally in any civic action, digging wells or anything?
No, we were just combat.
Right.
And I could probably think of some more. I haven't looked at them or thought about them for a long time. But a lot of them, like I say, I took them. I rated them retroactive. I took them, but they don't mean anything. The Vietnam service and the combat action are the only two I care about.
What about the officers?
They tend to get medals a little bit quicker.
Sure.
Oh yeah.
Sure.
I don't know a single officer that was in Vietnam that didn't get out at least a captain and get the Navy commendation with Combat V. Every one of them got that. It's like checking out the door. Here are your captain bars, and here's your personal decoration. I heard that colonels, and I got this, I believe, in the about face. What was the name of that guy? I can't think of his name. Everybody's read it. Army guy. I'll think of it in a minute. That in the Army, a colonel could fly over a firefight and get a Silver Star? Fly over a firefight and get a Silver Star. I'll think of his name in a minute. And the guy that he replaced as battalion commander had lost a lot of people and had not one single dead VC. He got promoted and a Silver Star for outstanding duty over there.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, about face. I'll think of his name. He died not long ago. Mm-hmm. It'll come to me. Great book about Vietnam. But officers, they always got them a lot easier. And I hate to say this too, but I have a book on all the Medal of Honor recipients from Civil War through Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And out at the, I hate to say this, there was an officer Medal of Honor recipient. And I read his citation compared to these privates. In my opinion, it's not quite the same.
How so?
It just didn't seem, well, gosh, I even hate to say this because I don't want to criticize the Medal of Honor. He didn't ask for it or anything like that. It just didn't seem like it was in the Medal of Honor vocabulary. And it may have been, I wasn't there or anything like that. I'm sorry I brought it up, but I just couldn't help it. It wasn't what these privates were doing. Like in World War II, you know, MacArthur getting a Medal of Honor for leaving Bataan of all things. You know.
Well, with MacArthur, you either are a fan or you're not a fan.
And I'm not a fan.
There's no in-between.
No, uh-uh. Dug out Doug. Uh-uh.
Well, that brings up another good area here. What about your officers? What was your opinion of your
officers? Oh, I would tell you, ours were good. Didn't know many higher up. You know, we knew we could answer the name of the battalion commander and stuff. Hardly ever saw him. Now, we had a captain. The only reason I'm going to tell you this is because it's in rumor war. And he's passed away now, but it's in rumor war. He didn't name him. He didn't name him, but he told who he was. He'd gone out with us on an operation and we got mortared and he ran. I mean, he ran big time. Never went back out in the bush again. He gets a Bronze Star. He got a Bronze Star.
Hmm. What about the leadership of your officers? Other
than that captain, and we said, now I'm going to tell you what we said, the only thing wrong with him, he was in the Army before he came to the Marine Corps. We did. That's what's wrong with him. He got too much Army in him. But my lieutenant, my platoon commander, was Lieutenant Vernon Yacht, Y-Yacht, and I tell you, that was one heck of a good officer. And I used to teach about Vietnam, and I don't anymore, and I will give an example. Lieutenant Yaxson was not career Marine, and we got to 327. He called the platoon around, and he said, I'm not a career Marine. I'm not looking for medals or anything like that. And he said, I'm not going to sacrifice any of you to get a good fitness report. But he said, we're Marines, and we're going to do our damn job. And we did. And I'll give you one example of what he did. When we were up on that mountain looking for that VC base camp that we finally found by stumbling into it and had that firefight where Vega got wounded.
Right.
Well, we're out in the middle of this triple canopy jungle and we had to get a medevac in. And you look at a map Now, the only way to know where you are is by key terrain features. Well, you can't see any key terrain features in the middle of a jungle. And so what the lieutenant did was this. He got on the radio, he looked at his map, and he picked out a coordinates. He doesn't have a clue whether that's where we are or not, but if you look at the chances are we're not there. Then he called in an artillery strike for that coordinates. And he told us to listen to the artillery. And when we could hear the shells exploding, he walked it over so he could get close enough to us that he knew what coordinates to call the medevac in.
Wow.
Now, these are the lieutenants that all the movies portray as being stupid.
Mm-hmm.
If any sergeant ever told Lieutenant Yaks what to do, it wasn't while I was with him. Nobody ever had to tell Lieutenant Yaks what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, he wasn't career or anything. That was just, and so the officers we had, except for that captain, I thought we're good. I didn't like all of them. Of course, Lieutenant Yaks is the one I saw all the time because he's my platoon commander.
And you were with him as the RTO?
Yeah, with him 24-7. Yeah, and the XO and the captains and other platoon commanders, I never was with them. But I didn't hear anyone complain about them. I just think they were good. I think especially the Marine Corps officers were good.
What makes a good officer in general?
I think just knowing his stuff, not wanting to sacrifice anybody for a ribbon or a medal or anything like that. That when he tells you to do something, you know that he knows what he's talking about. You don't have to question it. You know, I've heard since then about other units, like an Army unit that was told to go down this road, and they said they're not going to go down that road because that's a trap, that's an ambush. And the reason they had to go down that road is because they was calling in a B-52 strike, and they didn't have time to go back any other way. But they had to sit there and explain it to those people before they go down that road. Well, in the Marine Corps, they didn't need any explaining. You just went down the road. If they told you to do that, you went, at least with the ones that I had. They didn't get close to you. That you, an enlisted man would talk to an officer, even my lieutenant, in third person. He never said you or anything like that. And the reason is, of course, he doesn't want to get, we're not pals, we're not buddies, we're not friends. He's a lieutenant and I was a Lance Corporal. That was a relationship. And that kept that distance and like I say, just mainly knowing he knew what he was talking about. I don't remember anybody ever questioning him or not doing anything he said. He was just a good officer. He knew what he was doing and he did it. And I assume he cared about us. He said he did. And he's the one guy at my battalion reunion that I wanted to see, and I saw him last summer. And I was sure glad to see him, and I told him he was a great lieutenant. So other than that, I don't know. You know, they know what they're doing, and they do it. And you could tell they knew what they were doing. Other than that, I don't know. Now, also, I don't know who all you, I'm sure you've interviewed a lot of them, and this isn't necessarily for in the bush, but another thing in the Marine Corps, it's like on payday and in the chow line, you eat in reverse order of rank. The privates go first, the PFCs, Lance Corporals, and all of that. Officers are always the last. And I think that's important, too. You know, you take care of your people before you take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Was that pretty common in the Marine Corps? When you
Oh, yeah, it was the way it was, yeah. Yeah, that wasn't an individual choice. It was like that, as far as I know, every unit.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be like hot chow. Over there, you know, we got paid every 2 weeks. And we get MPC, military pay certificate. But most of the time, we just left it on the books. We didn't have anything to do with the money anyway. But even then, you went in reverse order of rank, privates first, PFCs, and all that stuff. Yeah.
There's a common held way a lot of people remember a lot of their officers in Vietnam was that they were indeed there to get their ticket punched.
Yes, and that's especially the Army, and that's another. And I wish I could think that guy's name. It'll come to me in a minute. That's another difference between the Marines and the Armies. They served 6 months, got the ticket punched, and moved up. Marines didn't do that. They were there the whole tour. The same lieutenant, if he didn't get killed or wounded, he was there the whole tour. They didn't ticket punch.
Was Lieutenant Yaks with your platoon the entire time then?
Yes, he was. Uh-huh. Yep. And I found out that was true of all the Marines. That was different from the Army.
Well, let me shift gears here a little bit and talk about some of the, some people would probably call it more mundane issues,
mm-hmm.
but as an individual, in a combat zone. I don't know that they would be all that mundane. It might be the thing you really look forward to the most. But what about life back when you would go back to base camp? What sort of things would you do? How often would you go back and what would you do?
Well, the base, we didn't have that. It's different from later on. We were on Hill 327, and that was what we'd call the front lines, and we went out from there. So we came back to Hill 327.
Okay.
So it wasn't like, and I used the movie Platoon, which I thought was a good movie. They didn't come back to rear echelon where, you know, they did dope and all that stuff. We didn't have that. We came back to Hill 327, and that's where we came back to. Every now and then, a member of the squad get on a 6x truck, and they take them down to Da Nang for the PX. He had a shopping list of things to get for you. But we didn't get any liberty into town or anything like that. A few of us did get R&R, and the way we did that was the lieutenant put our names in a helmet, and he drew names, and I happened to get my name drawn, and I got to go to Bangkok for 2 nights and 3 days, but not everybody got to do that.
Now, how long had you been in country when you got this first R&R?
Oh, gosh, 8 months maybe.
8 months?
Yeah.
What did R&R mean to you then after 8 months in the bush?
Oh, my gosh, all we did was drink and sleep with them gals. We never went to that hotel room. That's all we did. There was a real nice hotel that we checked into, and we left our uniforms there. And the way I remember it, we didn't come back for 3 days to pick the uniforms up to go and get back on the C-130 to go back to Vietnam. All we did was drink and stay with them women. That's all we did.
The whole time?
The whole time. No sightseeing or anything like that. Yep. And we had these ties back to these kids. They were like bellhops at this hotel. And they'd take us around and they'd help us to keep us from getting cheated and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were leaving, there were three of us, I remember. They gave each of us what I call a Buddhist St. Christopher. And they said, if you wear this, you won't ever get killed. I wore that on my dog tags.
Is that right?
I've still got it.
Now, this was a small Buddha that you could hang from your neck, I guess.
Yeah, and I've had Asians look at it, and they don't know which Buddha it is. I mean, they can't identify because you could. But, yeah, it was one of these Buddhist medals that you wear. And so I wore that on my dog tags, and I've still got that thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that's all we did was drink and stay with them women. That's all we did. Yep.
Well, after 8 months in the bush,
mm-hmm.
you get your first R&R, and only R&R, I assume.
Only one, yep.
Okay. You look forward to this. You do everything you can that you want to do while you're on R&R.
Uh-huh.
Now, when your time is up in Bangkok, you've got to go back up to
That's
Bangkok,
right.
You've got to go back to work.
Yeah.
When you headed into country, you didn't necessarily know what to expect.
Yeah.
But when you're on R&R, you're on a brief break from all of that.
Uh-huh.
And now you've got to head back, and you know exactly what to expect. What was it like for you to leave Bangkok and go back to the action?
Honestly, it wasn't all that bad. I mean, we knew we were going to be there for 3 days, and the camaraderie of that unit. I mean, it's just one of those things like, you know, well, I got to go back. And being a platoon operator, I took a lot of pride in that, you know. My platoon needs me back up there. And I don't remember, you know, dreading like, you know, oh, my God, I might get killed. I don't remember that. None of us did. There were three of us, and it was just kind of a matter-of-fact thing. And we got back in Da Nang. I have a picture this guy took of us on that airstrip at Da Nang. And I went down. I was about 130 pounds at that time. I went in the Marines at, around 210, got out of boot camp 175, and went into Vietnam about 170. I was down to about 128 pounds. It is unbelievable. And we're all like that. But, no, I don't remember having any real big problems with it or anything like that. It's just something we had to do, and we were glad we did it. That's all.
Was anyone resentful that you three got to go and no one else did?
No, I don't remember that. Even if they were, they didn't say that. We didn't have enough R&R so that everybody got to go. And so I know not everybody got to go, but I don't remember that. Even when I got back, and we didn't know for a long time. I mean, it wasn't like, well, you know what day you're leaving 2 months ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of like last of the minute type of thing, you know.
Sure.
And so it wasn't like I knew for weeks ahead of time I was going. It was almost like instantly.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's the way I remember it. But no, I don't remember any resentment or anything. And if there was, I didn't recognize any.
In the brief times that you were down, where you're not in the bush,
mm-hmm.
when you go back to the hill, What sort of things do you and the other Marines talk about? What do you do to relate to one another? What sort of things did you have going on with each other?
Okay, when we weren't, even down at the bunker where you stand and watch and everything, you could visit down there, but we go up to the tents and we talk about girls, girlfriends. One of the big things is what kind of car you're going to get when you get home.
What do you want?
Oh, I wanted a 57 Chevy because I hadn't gotten one. And even then, that was such a classic and everything. I never did get a 57 Chevy. I was in drag racing, not big time. I had a 60 Impala that I drag raced unofficially out on the highway.
Right.
But some of those guys, of course, they're really into the engines and everything. And so they had, you know, they wanted Thunderbirds and stuff like that. But what kind of car are you going to get? What were you going to do? I made up my mind I was going to go to college and everything. But a lot of what are you going to do when you get out, you know, and that kind of what kind of car are you going to get and stuff like that. That's what we talked about. We didn't really talk about Vietnam or anything like that. And but mainly girls and what we were going to do when we got out. Yeah, that's mainly what we talked about. And I don't remember anything else. Oh, and we let each people read our love letters.
So you're writing letters?
Yeah, if you got a girlfriend, you know, and you got your letter, you know, you share it. Make sure you let everybody read it. Yeah, you had to share that kind of stuff. Yeah, show pictures, stuff like that.
Now, were you corresponding with folks back home? Did you have a girlfriend back home?
But she didn't stay with me very long. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, you know we couldn't be married and get in the Marine Corps in those days, mm-hmm. which I think is really good, especially for the privates. You know, when you enlisted in those days, you could not be married. As I recall, you had to ship over and get company commander's permission and be a corporal. So we didn't have any wives to worry about. We just had girlfriends and stuff like that. But, yeah, I had a girl from high school that I wrote to. And she kept writing to me, but I think it's just because she felt like she had to. I wanted her to be my girlfriend. I don't think she was. And then there was another one, this beautiful twirler. I didn't know where she was. I knew she was University of Texas, so felt like Forrest Gump. I just wrote to University of Texas. A month later, I got it back, you know, of course, undeliverable. Needed a little bit more address than that. We talked about girls. We didn't drink. Well, we could. The Vietnamese would come up on our lines, these little Vietnamese kids, and they'd sell us this beer. I believe it was a nickel. And it was, we called it Tiger Bill.
Right.
Tiger beer. Mm-hmm. Never seen an ice cube. And so we get a couple of Tiger beers, but, you know, we had to keep that from the officers and everything. We never got drunk, but we get a couple of Tiger beers. Oh, another thing, too. When we went out on patrol, if you killed a VC, and it was confirmed, of course, then when we came back, you were given all the... And I think Caputo had this in his book, too, that you were given a beer and time to drink a couple of those things. Yeah, that was your reward for killing somebody, was it a beer. And it would be American beer, too. It would be Budweiser or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. The problem was, most of the time, you couldn't get a confirmed. You know, because of the way the jungles were and everything.
Right. And like you say, the VC hauled their dead and wounded.
Yeah, oh, yeah. A confirmed kill was difficult. I mean, there were a few of them. And there were a few of them, but vast majority weren't or anything like that.
What about you? Did you get any?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you this, and I don't know if I may be told on one person. It wasn't confirmed, but I know I killed one. And the only reason I'm doing this is because we're interviewing about when it was that time we found that base camp up in that jungle. And the way I remember it, we were in single file, and we had a fire team ahead of us. And all of a sudden, there's a lot of gunfire, and that's when Vega got hit. And Lieutenant Yax was motioning for everybody to get up there where the gunfire was. Now, this is amazing, but what I remember, we were single file, and on the near the edge of this giant mountain. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw one of them running, just running. And I just shot him and took him out right there. And I remembered firing. I knew it was empty when it didn't recoil anymore, and the guy went down. I didn't tell the lieutenant that. Now, this word sounds like BS, and I didn't tell anybody that. And I'm going to tell you why I did. Because I didn't want to make somebody, it wouldn't have been me, to go over there and try to find that dead VC to get a confirmed kill. You know, to call in or anything. So I just didn't tell anybody about it. And that's the only one that I killed. And I didn't tell anybody about it then. because I didn't want anybody to have to go over there and try to find that guy. And I'm pretty sure I killed him. If I didn't, I sure hit him. And that's the only one.
Now, you talk about these confirmed kills and body counts and things like that. What was your opinion of trying to measure progress in the war in terms of enemy?
Yeah, and again, that was later on. We didn't do that. Now, it was good to get kills, but we had to have them in front of us and stuff like that. When I say confirmed kill, that's a confirmed kill for the unit was a dead VC. It didn't matter who killed it. A confirmed kill for the individual, it was just kind of like, well, you got him and somebody saw you shooting, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
There were cases where two guys would be shooting at one and they'd get in an argument about who killed him. And the reason was, if you kill the guy, you got any souvenirs that were on him. And that was the reason. Plus, it was macho. You didn't get anything extra for it or anything like that.
Right.
Yeah, later on when I was reading about the importance of body count and everything, you know, and they started inflating it, 2 + 2 = 8 and all that kind of stuff. It just didn't do any good. I mean, it's just trying to put a good picture on a bad situation. Well, that's another thing in 65 with us. You know, we didn't inflate the body count or anything like that, you know. And they had to be there. We had to know they were dead. And that Denang 4 holder, you know, they had the list of the confirmed kills and everything. And there weren't many of them because they were hard to get. But a lot of that stuff I didn't know about. We were so early over there, and a lot of this stuff develops after we leave. And after I left, I didn't read about Vietnam or anything like that for, 25 years. And that's when I decided to teach a course so I'd learn something about it, make myself learn about it. So I started reading a little bit about it then. That's when I started learning about the inflated body counts and all that kind of stuff. Hackworth, Colonel Hackworth. That's
okay,
the guy. That,
right.
Now I just thought of his name, yeah. Yeah. That when I got out, when I was a drill instructor, of course, you did that. We'd hear what was going on in Vietnam, but didn't think, I mean, what are we going to think about it? Nothing, we're just training our platoons.
Right.
And, of course, then we didn't know. We were military, you know, we thought we were winning and all that. Then I went to college. Every now and then I would pay attention because I went to college. I got to SFA just when Tet Offensive hit. And so I was watching that on the news. And, well, I knew it was bad in the Tet Offensive. But I didn't think we were going to lose. I didn't think about it that much or anything. My roommates were both Marine Vietnam vets. And I don't know if I told you that last time. Pat Burke, boy, he got shot to pieces over there. And but we never talked about the war or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Not a bit. Mm-hmm. Just ask what unit you were with, and that was about the end of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, when you were back at the hill, you know, in your, whether you're in a bunker, standing guard, or whatever, you're a Marine, and you were of the West Coast Marines, as it were.
Yeah, Hollywood Marines.
Yeah, but who else was with you? Did you have, you're obviously from Texas.
Huh?
Who else was with you? Guys from California?
California, Boston, New York City. My lieutenant from New York City, Indiana, Ohio, all over. We had Mexicans, we had blacks, we had Italians. Oh, man, we had them from all over the place.
Now, that must have been quite a change of pace from someone who is somewhat isolated.
Yeah.
What was it like to live with these guys?
Well, I kind of got introduced to that in boot camp. And although it was so much different from East Texas, especially back then, I really didn't think that much of it. That we had a corporal that talked with that Boston accent. So I kept trying to tell him to say garage. I never heard anybody say garage like that. Then he had me describe a date in Henderson, Texas. He'd never heard of anything like that either. You know, and I'd ham it up a little bit, you know, like take him to the Strand Theater, then go to the Dairy Queen and buy him a Cherry Coke, you know.
Right.
Oh, he'd just laugh his ass off, you know. And my mother sent the Henderson Daily newspaper over there, which was all of 4 pages. Mm-hmm. And Lieutenant Yax was described in the New York Times. And when he saw that Henderson newspaper fall out of that mail sack, he could not believe it. And then you read some of the news in there, you know, Cal got loose. Yeah. And I don't know, I just didn't think that much of it. And it was interesting because my best buddies, neither one of them were from Texas. They were from Ohio and never thought anything about it. I knew a few Texans, but you know me, what was a big deal about a Texan? I was one of them too, you know?
Right.
And one of the Texans was Hispanic. And I think one was an Anglo like me, but there was no reason to be especially good friends with a Texan because we were from different places too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't like somebody from my hometown or anything like that.
Right.
But, I mean, these guys were, I don't think they're good guys, but they weren't the type you take home to meet mother either. I mean, some of them pretty rough characters. Yeah, but the two guys I was with, one was Ohio. I think both of them were from Ohio. And they were just good people. And most of them were, I guess, most of them were.
Now, you'd mentioned earlier that
Let me say something, because I don't know what other people tell you. And this, again, is just my platoon, these nicknames.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody's uncle seen Forrest Gump. And that guy was a Vietnam vet that wrote that and all that. And a lot of it is just humor. But when Forrest Gump, you know, says that Texas nickname and he's from Oklahoma and all this kind of stuff. Well, that's not the way we got nicknames. And I'll say this. As far as camaraderie and all that stuff among our platoons, you never called another Marine by his first name, ever. I don't care how close you were, you never called him by his first name. You always used his last name or his nickname. Never called him by his first name. Nicknames seemed to be assigned. If they called you something and you didn't like it, that's your nickname. You're stuck with it. Like WAP. Wetback. You're stuck with it. And then some of it would just be, my nickname was Tex for obvious reasons and stuff like that. And not everybody had a nickname. But that's the way you got them. If one of them called you something and you didn't like it, you're stuck with that damn name the whole time. And there are guys in my battalion, even when I go to the reunions, I know their nickname, but I ain't got a clue what their real names are.
Is that right? Still to this day?
Yeah. Uh-huh, to this day. Or I may know his last name, and I won't have a clue what his first name is. And that's just the way it was. You just didn't call their first name at all, last name or nickname, and that was it. Yep.
You mentioned a little bit ago that some of these guys were a little rough.
Yeah.
You didn't necessarily like all the guys.
No, you didn't, and that's the strange thing about the camaraderie.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't realize what we had until you lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true of a lot of things, because some of these guys had been in trouble. And the way I understood, if you got in trouble and you went to the recruiting office and they did this background check, they just misspell your name. Put two E's in it instead of one or something like that. And some of the guys from the cities, and you know, they were pretty tough guys. And so I didn't necessarily like every one of them. But after we left, and especially after I got out of the Marine Corps, is when I realized how close we actually had been. And I'd never had friends like that ever again. Ever, ever, ever. And again, it was something that you had, but you didn't even recognize it when you had it. Again, it's something you didn't know you had until you lost it. Once it was gone, you never had anything like that again.
What was it like to lose some of this camaraderie?
It was devastating, you know, and it wasn't like I know I'm losing it. It's when you start thinking back that when I went to that first reunion and I saw those guys for the first time after 20 years, it was like coming home. I'd never felt like that with any other group. It was unbelievable. And I think it's because, you know, they saw you in pretty tough times. And I was nervous about going. I found out some of the others were. Because you want to make sure that you did okay over there. We'd all worried, you know, but we did okay. But when I saw, the first one I saw was Sergeant Kobe. And it was just like coming home after 20 damn years or something. And virtually nobody talked war stories. We got drunk, God almighty, we got drunk, and we just talked, well, we visited, we talked, well, if you had wives and stuff, but it was just unbelievable what a relief it was. I just can't describe what a feeling it was with those guys. And that's when I really realized what we had over there. And I've told my brother this, and he agreed. I said, I was closer to those guys than I've ever been to you. And that's because of the situation we were in. We did things together that my brother and I have never done together. And it not only was combat, it was, you know, going to these places in Okinawa and stuff like that. We did everything together. And you lived together. And that's just where it came from. And you trusted those guys. You didn't have to worry about it. You know, they had your back. They took care of you as best as they could. And there's never been anything like that again, ever. And I'm sure that's the way these units feel today. And they don't realize it until they get home. And they realize it then that that's something else. I don't know any other way to get it.
Were there any instances of trouble, of people just not liking one another to the point where there was hostility within the unit?
Not that I know of. But again, you know, this memory and all, I do not remember that anybody was trying to kill anybody else. I don't remember any big fist fights or anything like that, even back on Okinawa. I just don't remember it. And they cuss each other out and stuff like that. But I don't remember anything like that, not in my platoon. They just kind of leave each other alone or something like that. I don't remember one single fist fight like that. And because it's been so, that doesn't mean there wasn't one, but I surely don't remember one like that. And the things they do, they say some of the stuff I don't know whether to tell you or not, but we had this one guy that fell in love with one of these Okinawan prostitutes. He just madly in love with her. So he'd never do anything with her, but everybody else would. Well, his buddy came back and went over to his rack and woke him up and told that he'd been with her. And boy, that guy came out of it. Now, there was one fist fight then, but it was just funny as hell. But no, I don't remember anything like that. I just really don't. Mm-mm. Not from my platoon.
What about issues of race? You said there were African Americans, that there were Hispanics,
yeah,
and whites.
There was probably a little tension, but nothing that spilled over like the race problems that are going to come about later. You know, of course, the blacks were proud of being blacks and stuff like that, but I don't think anybody ever rubbed it in. I just don't remember anything. I'll be honest, you know what? My best friends were whites, and the blacks went off with the blacks, and even in the platoon, you know. If they wanted to come with us, they could have. But I don't know. I don't know. But yeah, there was a little bit of tension, but nothing that erupted into any fights or anything like that I know of. I know when he's getting ready to leave, I told this one black Marine that if he ever got into Henderson, come by and I'd buy him a good hamburger. And he looked at me and he said, "You can't do that, Tex." He said, "They don't serve niggers in Henderson, Texas." And, you know, they didn't in those days. And that's when he realized, no, I couldn't do it. We couldn't even go into Henderson hamburger joint together.
Well, what was that like for you? You've grown.
It was strange. I mean, we've been over there fighting together, and that was true then. There were places in Henderson, Texas, I could not have taken him. And, yeah, that was kind of strange. Yep. And you know what? I told him why. I said, "I'll bring it out to you."
How did he react to that?
Yeah. He just laughed. I said, "This place is a car hop. We'll just order from the car. You know, I just bring it out to you." But I don't remember much. I know it got worse a little bit later on. And it probably got worse among guys that weren't in the combat area. You know, I just can't see doing that in combat. You know, back in the rear, that'd be different. But I don't really remember much, although there was a little, you know, because I wasn't with blacks when I was growing up or anything like that. But we seemed to tolerate each other pretty good. You know, I've forgotten a lot of this stuff, too.
Sure.
You know, I have forgotten a lot of it. You know, stuff that went on every day, but nothing so outstanding like somebody almost killing another guy or anything like that. Because some of the guys in there, like I said, with these nicknames and everything, I mean, they would be just the type that would pick on somebody. But I don't remember anything that bad or anything like that.
Well, what about when you're getting short, when your time to come home is starting to draw near? What sort of things are you thinking about?
Well, we're mainly thinking about what we're going to do. Now, I wasn't getting out of the Corps, so I knew, you know, I had a couple of more years. And we weren't, you know, I think I told you last time, we thought we were going to go to Pendleton and then come back to Vietnam. And we're going to just, you know, I wasn't worried. I just, the way it was, it wasn't anything to think about. But we were mainly talking what we were going to do when we got home on leave and stuff like that. And then when they I don't remember if they told us they were going to break us up, or we just got orders and found out that we were broken up. Because I don't remember saying goodbye to anybody except, I guess then, because when we got back to the States, we got orders of where we were going to go after our 30 days leave, and that's when we knew we'd been broken up. Because I was going to go to the 2nd Marine Division, and my best buddy was going to go there too, so that was okay. You know, what company are you in? But that was about it. Mainly what we're going to do on leave and stuff like that, and get drunk and go out with the girls and that kind of stuff.
When did you leave Vietnam?
Left Vietnam in September of 65. Went to Okinawa. We did a. They took us to the Philippines. The ship did. We were at Manila for a day or so. Got drunk over there. Then went to Hong Kong for 2 days. Back to Okinawa, and we were there about 3 weeks, doing whatever it took to get us ready to come back to the States. And then with another 35 days or so on that troop ship before we got back to the States. And when we were coming in, that's when we found out there were, as I remember, thousands of protesters going to greet our ship when we got in.
In 65. This was
65. It had been in the newspaper that we were coming in. And the way I remember it, when we got off that ship, there was a line of police officers from San Diego. And we had to go between them, running between them, to get on this Marine Corps bus.
As early as 1965?
65, yes, sir. And they were screaming, and I won't say they were spitting, but boy, they had the signs and everything. In 65.
What was your reaction to that? That must have been very strange, I would think.
It was. And I didn't, you know, again, it's amazing. You know, I just thought this is stupid, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And got on bus. It's kind of hard to, you know, because you're like, well, why don't she? I don't know. I just thought it was weird and everything, and got on the bus. I was so worried. I was so glad to be getting home and all. And my buddy said, you know, if they give us those M14s back, we wouldn't need any policemen over there. And
which is why you didn't have the M14s.
Yeah, because they, and then a lot of people, some of these people think that they give them to you and you just bring them home. And you can't do that. they loan them to you. They want them back.
They want them well used, but they do want them.
Yeah, they want them used, but boy, they want them back, you know. And so when we were coming back to the States, we didn't have any weapons on them. And even when we were going over, they would have them down in the cargo hold and everything. And but, yeah, we had San Diego policemen there in what we call the cattle cars, what we were getting on. And it's a truck, like an 18-wheeler with a big thing in the back that they carry passengers and everything in. But, yeah, we were met by protesters. Yep. And it didn't bother me too much then. And when I got home to Henderson, I'll tell you what, I found out that there were people that were calling my parents at 3 o'clock in the morning telling them I'd been killed over there.
Really?
Mama told me that. And I bought a 62 Chevy and a Marine Corps emblem on it, and they came by and egged that damn car. They egged it. And one of the reasons I mentioned it was so long out of country till I got back home, my mother told me years later, she said, even after all that time, she said, you were wound up tighter than a drum. And she said, when somebody came to the door, I prayed they weren't coming to see you. And I did not realize that. I was still wound up from all of that. And that was after over a month out of country.
Now, when you say that you were wound up.
Yeah.
You mean in terms of just your general attitude?
Yeah, general attitude. And again, I didn't realize that till my mother told me years later. You know, I thought I was just a good old guy, but she apparently said I was wound tight as a drum. She was literally scared if somebody was coming over to see me. And I didn't realize that. So, and even to this day, I mean, like, be honest, when I talk about Vietnam like this, I won't sleep tonight. I won't do it. And you can't explain why, you just won't do it. And there's no reason for it. There's absolutely no reason for it. And there it is. And so I guess that's what it was. Where we'd been and what these people were like over here, my God, you know, it was more important about who won the damn high school football game. You know, and we'd seen guys get, you know, we had guys killed and everything, and that got me more than anything. And then when I went down to SFA to see my brother, he was enrolled down there. I was tempted to shoot me in the damn finger because I had that Marine Corps uniform on. Of course, not right up close, anything like that. And, you know, that was that was kind of hurting. And then a little bit later on, I've been in cafes and stuff where they literally had signs, no dogs or Marines served in here.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
In the Henderson area?
Well, not in Henderson. This is up not around Camp Lejeune or Paris Island, but kind of off in the area. Not all of them, but I've seen that. I was in a cafe once with a uniform. Nobody would come wait on me. And so I asked a waitress, and she said, we don't serve dogs and Marines. And I just got up and left. I tell you about the VFW that slammed the door in our face?
No, you didn't. Is this when you just came?
Charleston, South Carolina.
Okay.
And a couple of buddies of mine, we had our uniforms on. Or maybe we did. We had the short haircut. And we decided to go to the VFW there to get some beer and knocked on the door, and they opened it. And we may have had our uniforms on. I don't know. And this guy said, what do you want, boys? And we said, well, we want to come in and get a beer. He said, you been in a war? I said, yeah, we in Vietnam. And he said, no, you had to be in a real war to come in this place. Slammed the damn door in our face.
Now, I would assume this would be a World War II era.
Yes, World War II. Had to be in a real war to come in here, boy. Yep.
How does that make you feel?
Oh, mad as hell. I had people here at college 20 years later. In the faculty lounge where we used to go, he was an 82nd Airborne. And when he found out I'd been to Vietnam, he got up so mad, cussing me out, he left that damn lounge. He said, at least we won our damn war.
Wow.
And I thought, what about these guys sitting with me that weren't even in the service? You're not mad at them. Just me you're mad at. And he was. Mad at us. And it wasn't just here. It was on vacation. I had it quite a bit. Had a Vietnam vet cert on Marine Corps, and this guy out in damn New Mexico somewhere in an antique dealer. He said, were you in the Marines? Yes, sir. Were you in Vietnam? Yes, sir. He said, we didn't have no damn parade when I came home. I said, I didn't have no damn parade either. Yep. You know, you just wonder, it just bothers you. Shut up, man. We didn't have no, my God. Yeah, it's still, now they don't do it quite like they did, but it was a long, long time. That they just wouldn't let you forget that they were in the real war. You weren't. Yep. Yep.
So it sounds to me that you've got it from both sides.
You did. You got it from everybody. You were damned if you did and damned if you didn't. Yep. And, I mean, it upset me a little bit. You know, it stayed with you a long time.
Did you become bitter because of
that? Yeah, damn bitter. Yeah. You know, because like I wanted to say to that guy, why don't you chew these people out that weren't even in the service? You know, no, they were okay, just you, for being in Vietnam. Yeah, and I don't know about some of these civilians around here, because, you know, I don't tell them I was in Vietnam or anything like that. I don't know what their attitude would have been. And this was an amazing long time after the Vietnam War had ended, too. Because I didn't come to Kilgore until 1977, when I came. That was a few years after Vietnam. And that's another thing about that reunion, because I started realizing that at the time there was everybody I know at Kilgore College about what I know of the fact and all. There's only two of us at Marine Corps of Vietnam, only two of us, and it was very rare to find somebody here had been in the service. And that's when I started realizing, you know, about those guys I'd been with and all. Yeah. But anyway, that's the way it is. And, you know, I don't talk about it anymore. I didn't even talk about it then much. But it stays with you. You never forget it. Yep.
Let me take you back to coming back to the United States. You've seen the protesters. You're making your way back to Henderson. You've got 30 days leave, right?
Uh-huh.
And what sort of things were you doing over these 30 days?
Oh, drinking. Doing a lot of drinking. Of course, I had to be with my parents and stuff. So, you know, just even though I was a Marine and all that, I still mom and dad.
Right.
You know?
Did you know where you were going once your 30 days was up?
Yeah, I was going to 2nd Marine Division at Lejeune.
Okay.
Back to an infantry unit. And from there is where I went to be a drill instructor, was from there.
Now, why were you chosen?
I'm going to tell you why I was chosen. And again, I may have explained this last time, but when I meet a Marine and tell them that, because when I was in the Corps to be a drill instructor, you had to ship over, re-enlist for DI school. So we had to have four in the Corps and ship over. Well, I went to the drill field after only 2 years. And the reason was, and this is what we heard, they waived that for the Corps that if you were 21, a corporal, and then 2 years in the Corps, you could go to drill instructor school. And they wanted Vietnam vets on the drill field real quick, what they call the yellow ribbons. They wanted yellow ribbons down there right now. And I wasn't the only one. I got a picture of the guys that were with me in that class, and about a third of us were first enlistment Marines that were corporals. And the way I got it is I was a squad leader in the 6th Marines, and apparently I'd given some class or something, throwing a damn hand grenade or something. And the first sergeant called me in the office, and he said he liked the way I did that. Had I ever thought about being a drill instructor? And I said, no, heavens no. He told me they had waived that 4 in the Corps. I had my 2 in. I was a corporal. And they wanted Vietnam vets down there. And he said there was some officers or somebody coming by for prospective prospects to go to DI school. And then I ought to go over there and see them. And I said, well, I can't be a drill instructor. 1/10, 1% of Marines are drill instructors. And he said, Stroud, the class don't start for a couple of weeks, you get 10 days home on leave, and then you go. And he said, if you don't make it, you're coming right back here. You ain't got a damn thing to lose. And I had to, well, I hadn't thought about that.
Now, did being a drill instructor appeal to you in any way?
Not really, except getting out of the infantry did. I promise you that. Yeah, it didn't really appeal to me, and I didn't think I could make it. But like I said, if you don't make it, you're coming back here, and you get 10 days home on leave anyway. And we had to go before this board. There were some officers and I guess some sergeants. And the only question they asked me is if I made it as a drill instructor and a black recruit spit in my face, what would I do? And I was smart enough to know how to answer that.
What'd you say?
I said, sir, when I'm a drill instructor, I would know the limits of punishment and I would punish him within the limits, sir. That may have gotten me into DI school. Because that's the question, and that was about the answer that I gave him. And next thing I know, I had orders for DI school.
Tell me about DI school. Where was it?
It was in Parris Island.
Okay.
And east of the Mississippi is Parris Island, and west of the Mississippi is San Diego. And it's one of the toughest schools I've ever been to. We went in, and that first day, I don't remember how many were there, maybe 70. And this sergeant major came out, and he said, you have difficulty finding a desk in here today. In 2 weeks, there are going to be plenty of empty damn desks. If we don't wipe out 50% of you, we're not doing our job. And I guarantee you he did his job. He got rid of 50% of them.
What was it like? What were the classes
like? He did. We went through this. Now, they reduced boot camp from 3 months to, I believe, 8 weeks because of Vietnam. They did that during World War II also. And like the sergeant major at DI school said, that with 3 months, we turned out Cadillacs. With 8 weeks, we turned out Fords. They both get us where we're going. What was tough about it was this. We had to go through and do everything physically that our recruits had to do. Now, we'd done that in boot camp, but, you know, that's been a while before. We had to learn how to teach everything. Everything. And it was things like how to stand at attention. Right shoulder arms, left shoulder arms, forward march. And the way you did it is they gave you these notebooks with all this stuff typed out. And like in the position of tension, there are 7 steps to the position of attention. And so you had to know them, and we had attention, parade dress and stuff like that, movements without weapons, without arms. Then we had a movement with arms, like left shoulder arms, present arms and all that. Then we have platoon marching. So this is what they do. Is after we learned all the movements without arms, without weapons, then they would take each one of these movements and put them in a drill instructor hat. One of the instructors would, and you drew one, and you had to teach that. And that instructor was standing there with a clipboard, and every time you didn't say something you're supposed to, he took points off. If you were not talking loud enough to be heard by 80 recruits clearly on a windy day, he divided your score by half. When you lost 200 points, you were out of DI school. You lost points at inspection. That when they inspected you, if, and going, we all knew this, but
The tip of the Marine Corps belt buckle can be no closer to the buckle than 2 inches, no farther than 4 inches. And so when they measure that, if it's over, you lose points like that. We ran all the time, but mainly it was taking these tests and having to teach these movements and everything. And that was the hardest part. But I got good at memorizing that because I didn't seem to have any trouble with that. And I think that helped me in college and even in teaching and everything. That was the hardest part, but remembering, because I couldn't even begin to tell you how much of that stuff we had to know. It's every single thing a recruit has to know.
Who are you trying to teach this to?
Recruits. Okay. Oh, who did we do it for?
Yes.
In the school, we just did it to the rest of them, like they'd be standing there.
Okay.
And then we would pretend they were our recruits, and it'd be an instructor. It'd been a former drill instructor. And so he's the one grading you on that stuff. So you'd be teaching it to your classmates.
Are you using the same kind of language, the same kind of approach you would to recruits to these guys?
No. No. We didn't cuss in the school. That never came up, but we did cuss on the drill field. Yeah, we did do that. Because even in teaching, you know, you might cuss them every now and then, but basically we just had to know how to teach right shoulder arms, left shoulder arms. We had to know how to do that, what to say. And so that wasn't anybody thinking about using any cuss words or anything. But yeah, that was probably the hardest part because I mean, this was a thick notebook. There was a whole lot of stuff that I can't even think. It's every single thing a recruit's going to know. I mean, Marine Corps history, bayonet fighting, marksmanship. I mean, everything. First aid, all of this. And of course, being a drill instructor, you don't use notes. You better know it all. And so that was the hardest part of it. But we practiced and we got it done, those of us that graduated.
Now, how long was this? Was the DI school also 8 weeks?
8 weeks, yeah.
Okay.
It was exactly how long boot camp was.
Okay.
And, of course, if the recruits run 3 miles, we're running 5 miles. We did everything. Bayonet fighting, we did everything a recruit had to do.
What gave you the most trouble, other than the memorization and doing these kinds of things? Was there anything physically that gave you
any trouble? No, we were in such good shape, no. Mm-hmm. Those five-mile runs were nothing. And it wasn't just – now, some of these old corps, some of the older ones it was, that had some soft duty stations and stuff, but I just come from the infantry. That was no big deal. But some of these guys that maybe been on recruiting duty somewhere, yeah, that running and physical could get to them, but not the guys that just came from the infantry.
Now, when do you graduate from DI school?
I've got the book on the thing right over there. It would be in 1966.
Okay.
I believe in March 13th, I think, 1966. And I did that till I got out of the Corps in January of 68.
Where were you stationed? Were you stationed there at Paris?
Paris Island.
Okay.
At Paris Island, South Carolina.
Okay, at Paris Island. And you got out in 68, you say?
Yeah, January to go to college. Got out 10 days early.
As a Vietnam veteran, did they give you any special insight into in your role as a drill instructor, or was it just Vietnam didn't even enter into it as you were drilling?
What they told us is every one of you know how to be a drill instructor because you had drill instructors. That what most of you are going to do is you imitate your drill instructor. They didn't tell us what to do as drill instructors, except the basic stuff. Vietnam entered into that boot camp every day.
How so?
Every day.
Tell me how.
They knew where they were going. They were going as infantry. They were going to Vietnam, and we were trying to save their lives. Every day we told them that. Now, people today think that it was legal to hit those recruits if you see Full Metal Jacket.
Mm-hmm.
It was never legal to hit those recruits. Never. But we did it. And the way we did it, I wrote a paper on this in college, The Role Analysis of the Marine Corps Drill Instructor. I wish I still had that. If you didn't go in there the first day, you had to get them loyal to you. I mean, there's a method to this. Two assistant drill instructors and a senior. That didn't mean you're nice to them. I mean, you're cussing these people up one end and down the other. You're scaring the daylights out of them. But the reason we would hit them is we would tell them that you're going to Vietnam and you make one mistake, Charlie's going to kill you. He's going to kill you. We're trying to save your life, and that you can turn us in any day you want to. We cannot touch you. You can get us court-martialed. You can have our stripes. But we're willing to sacrifice our stripes to try to save you in Vietnam. And, boy, that did it. When I had a recruit, one of the worst things I could do to a recruit is tell them I'm not going to touch you because you're not worth my stripes. And I had them beg me to knock the shit out of them, believe it or not. And they took pride in it, and we had to tell them, you don't, when you go in the mess hall, you don't talk, but you darn sure don't tell some other platoon, don't brag, because they were proud about that. But yeah, they weren't supposed to, but we did it. We'd hit them, we'd choke them, just like in Full Metal Jacket, stuff like that, but we'd constantly let them know, we don't have time to explain to you what you did wrong. And when you get to Vietnam, they're not going to explain it either. You're going to just be dead. And they appreciated that because they knew they were going to Vietnam, too. We didn't tell them war stories or anything like that. We didn't do that. We just constantly reminded them where they were going. You were going as infantry, and that what we were trying to do was save their lives over there. Although what we did didn't have much to do with combat. That was infantry training regiment. But what we did do was we instilled the discipline in them that they were going to need. That's right. What we were doing.
Right.
And we told them, if you can't take this, you can't take Vietnam. And that's what that was for.
But they were going anyway.
They're going, yeah. Unless they get psyched out. You know, you go crazy. Yeah, you're going. Unless you go crazy here. And if you're going to go crazy, we're going to drive you crazy. That's what our... We want to try to drive you crazy here before you go to Vietnam. Yeah.
Now, as a Vietnam-era drill instructor... And you brought up the movie Full Metal Jacket
uh-huh.
a couple of times, and of course probably the most maybe entertaining is not the word to say, but it is damned entertaining.
Yeah, it is.
The movie
uh-huh.
is R. Lee Ermey and his. Of course, he was a drill instructor.
He was. Now, I'm going to tell you something.
How accurate was he?
He's accurate. He and I were DIs at the same time.
Is that
I
right?
Didn't know him. I didn't know him until he got famous, and I read a little biography in the Marine Corps magazine. He was in 2nd Battalion when I was at 1st Battalion at Parris Island. He was as accurate as you can be for Hollywood on that screen.
Now, you say for Hollywood.
Well, for being on Hollywood.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, this is where, this is the inaccuracy, and it's not much. It's hardly worth mentioning. But he was a senior drill instructor. He had the black belt on. You see the assistant standing behind him at parade dress? That's bull. All three of them are doing what he was doing. And the ones that were the meanest were the two assistants, not the senior.
Is that right? Now, were you yes. senior or were you assistant?
I was assistant.
Okay.
A senior would have been a staff sergeant or a gunny.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the assistant DIs, which originally we called junior DIs, but they didn't like that, so they changed it. We were the ones that they said were tightening their asses. We were the badasses. And although the senior was not much nicer than what he was in that movie, that was nice compared to the two juniors.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How were you worse and why?
Well, we PT'd them more. We hit them more. We cussed them more. We did all of that. It was like the senior was the one that was their daddy.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the asshole brother-in-laws. It was just relative. And it was kind of planned out that way.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't get many breaks and stuff, but a lot of times it would be the senior that would do that. You know, what little kindness they got, it would be the senior, not the assistants doing that stuff.
Well, I can see why that would be the case. You,
uh-huh.
you want to build a loyalty to
yes.
a certain
uh-huh.
figure of authority within the
unit uh-huh.
that makes perfect
yeah.
sense.
Yeah, uh-huh. And so that's the way it was. And that's the biggest fault was the assistants in the movie were just standing there parade dress. No, they were the ones doing everything.
Mm-hmm.
And the senior would be too, but mainly it was the two assistants that were doing that.
Now, did you have any cases of problems with discipline? Did you have anyone challenge your authority as a drill instructor?
Nope. Mm-mm. Nope.
For 2 years?
They were scared to death. Scared to death. No, sir. And I've had people that weren't in the service say, they hit me, you have no clue what you're going to do until that drill instructor starts screaming at you. You people don't have a clue what that's like. Because you get all these tough guys... No, they wouldn't touch me. Well, okay, you don't need to go then. Because, I mean, that when we picked them up, started out, I mean, these guys are scared to death. And I heard that they did analysis, and these people are literally in a mild state of shock for like 3 days.
Wow.
They can't even remember their first day. Yeah. And most people, and the reason I think that was, and I didn't hear about it, and if it happened, it hardly ever happened that anybody would do that. And I think there's a reason that most people went to the Marine Corps, because they knew about the Marine Corps from people that had been in the Marine Corps, and they knew what boot camp was like before they ever got off that bus. And that's what they wanted. That's why they were there. So I don't think it was like, I thought this was Boy Scout camp. They knew exactly what they were getting into. And these drill instructors, and with me, a lot of it's just an act. They're given an image that I don't care whether you challenge me or not, I'm going to kill you. You know, it'd be better for your life if you just keep your damn mouth shut. And that's the image that we were given. And I mean, it apparently worked. They never challenged our authority to do a damn thing. Not any platoons that I had or anything. No, sir. No. And I will tell you this, I can still get like that today. I don't do it. But I'm going to tell you, they're putting on a play here called A Few Good Men.
Mm-hmm.
And when they did it years ago, and the director just saw me the other day to ask me, she had me come over and treat them like recruits for 5 minutes.
That must have been a treat.
I got up there and I asked her, I said, can I hit them? She said, no. I said, can I cuss them? Yes. I cussed. I did just like I did as a drill instructor for 5 minutes. And I promise you, boys were crying. When they left, I heard horror stories about what they were telling each other. It was 5 minutes compared to 8 weeks. Yeah, I can still do it. Yeah, I can still do it. And until you're there in that atmosphere and that man is doing that to you, people don't have a clue what they're talking about. All that stuff. They wouldn't talk to me that way. Yeah. And but no, nobody ever did that. And we were tough, mean, if you want to call it mean. We were tough on those guys. And I tell you another thing that I've got is I don't tell anything except for killing that VC. I can't back that up. That's just me. But being a drill instructor, I've got a photograph that they used in Marine Corps literature of me as a drill instructor. I didn't even know about it for 20 years. But I have something else, too, that when our recruits were getting ready to leave, we would have them write a letter to the drill instructor telling what they thought of each one of us in boot camp. And we told them, don't sign it, and we won't read it until after you leave, and then we're going to burn them. Well, with this particular set, there's about 35 of these letters. I was coming home on leave for 10 days, and the senior drill instructors, we were terrified about these letters. It was court-martial material and everything. He told me, he said, take them to the piney woods of East Texas and burn them. And I was out in the piney woods of East Texas with a match, and I didn't burn them. I still got those things.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Why did you keep them?
I don't know. But I bet you the only surviving set of what we call love letters from the Vietnam era, they don't do that anymore. And there's my name with the other drill instructors and everything they thought about us. And I guarantee you that when I say I was a bad son of a bitch, I got the letters to back it up.
What sort of things did they say?
Oh, they said that I was crazy, wanted to kill them. I would look like a mad dog and all this kind of stuff. I've got them right over here. I mean, and if you want to see cuss words misspelled, these letters will do it. I will guarantee you've never seen cuss words as misspelled as these letters. Oh, my God. Oh, yeah, crazy. One of them said he thought I was crazy the first day, and he never changed it. I was the meanest goddamn Marine he'd ever seen. Oh, yeah. Maybe I could make some copies and send a few of them up there to you.
we'll have to talk about that. That's pretty good stuff.
Yeah, well, let me get them real quick. I think that they're over here somewhere. But I mean, and the one I can share with people is one of the recruits said that he would sooner be a woodpecker and peck his way to hell than go through boot camp again. I was going to do an article on that Vietnam magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote them and told them about it, and they said, yeah, they'd like to have that article, but I couldn't have any profanity.
Oh, for crying out loud.
You take profanity out of those letters, you got nothing. Because it's all there, people. It is all there. And I mean, so, and I will tell you, you read those letters, I was the baddest one of those three drill instructors.
Yep.
So, yeah, I'd be glad to make, if I could, make a copy and let you at least look at them or something.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, they're
hard to mess up.
I've got them over here in this file cabinet somewhere. Cause I'm glad I kept them. And I don't know what to do with them, but, you know, it's, and I can tell you what platoon it was and everything. It was 1960. And these guys were the ones that hit Tet Offensive. That's about the time they got over there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the only reason I know is, although we told them not to sign their name, some of them did.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew from that platoon, I knew what platoon it was.
How many groups did you go through there?
Seven or eight. We have a book. They would give us photographs of a platoon. When they got ready to graduate, they'd have their photograph made. And so I've got all of those over in a book over here. I think it was seven platoons or something like that. Maybe eight. I'd have to count them. There was one. Enlistment picked up very quickly when colleges turned in their grades. These kids flunking out of college. And there was one time where I had to work two platoons. Well, you're getting ready to graduate one, and you pick up another one at the same time. You had to split time between the two of them. Only had to do that once, though. But they were coming in that fast after the fall semester, about Christmas time or something like that. But yeah, I've got, there's about seven platoons I put through. Sometimes it would be back-to-back, and sometimes you might be off for 2 or 3 weeks waiting for another platoon to form. And so that's about how many, about seven at the most, I think.
Now, you did this until when in 1968?
I got out in January of 68, and I think I was working a platoon when I got out, like January the 12th. As you know, in those days, the fall semester, you came back after Christmas and did your finals.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was going to be the spring semester that I got started down at SFA. So it was sometime in January. But they let me out like on January the 12th or something like that.
He said they let you out a little early because...
Yeah, it's on my DD-214, 10 days early out to go to college.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what did you want to do when you went to college?
History, teacher. History. That's all. I never had to worry about anything. I loved history. At least I thought it. I did love it, but I didn't know much. Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought I did. I didn't know much. And being a drill instructor is when I realized I wanted to be a teacher. Because I did, as different as it is, that's when I liked it. I loved doing that. Not to be mean, but just teaching those kids stuff and seeing what they were like on graduation day compared to that first day. So that's when I decided I would be a teacher, and the only thing I liked was history, so I was going to be a history teacher. So that's why I went to SFA. And I wouldn't have gotten into A&M. I wouldn't have gone to A&M because it was all cadets in those days, and there's no way I could have got accepted to any college. I got into SFA on scholastic probation like it was. And it was close enough to home that I could come see my parents if I wanted to.
Sure.
60 miles from work, from Henderson, or whatever it is. And yet I didn't have to live at home. And so I had no other, there was no other place I wanted to go. You know, I couldn't have got into UT or anything like that. I was just glad to get into SFA. And, that's where I went. And I had some trouble. Met two Marines for roommates. That was important. You know, my first roommate was an 18-year-old named Pig. They called him Pig. And he said he was going to go on the Air Force Reserve, but his mother cried, so he decided not to go. But I met these other two Marines, and we got off campus. And that helped. But we also had an ex-GI fraternity. And 99% of those guys were Vietnam vets. And there weren't many of us, but that helped also. So I got to be around some Vietnam vets and just some other service guys, too. In fact, SFA started that again, and they had me go down and talk to them about a year and a half ago because they were amazed that they knew about that one from the 60s, but they didn't know and they found out I was there, and the guy that was a former student of mine asked me to come down there and talk to him. But that did help, and like I say, we didn't talk about war. We got drunk together, we had beer bus together and stuff like that, but just being around another vet was an important thing. That was the important thing, is that they knew where you were coming from.
Right.
And that was the important thing, and that helped that way.
Now, you said you got into some trouble one time?
Let's see. When I got in trouble, what would remind me of that?
I may have misheard you. I thought you said that you got in a little bit of trouble while you were there at SFA, maybe with these other Marines as roommates. I may have misheard you.
No, I didn't get in trouble with them. Okay. No.
All right. Now, how much time did you spend there at Stephen F. Austin?
How much time?
Mm-hmm.
How long did I spend there?
Yes.
4 years. I got my bachelor there. And I got that in 72, and then after I taught 4 years at West Rush, but I was going back and got my master's at SFA, too. I spent 4 years and probably a few months. I had to go to summer school a few times, make up a few bad grades and stuff.
Now, did you teach secondary education? Did you teach high school initially?
I taught eighth graders.
Eighth graders, okay.
Eighth graders, yeah, at West Rush, which used to be Gaston in New London. And then from there, I got my master's, and I got on over here to Kilgore.
Mm-hmm. Now, when did you go to Kilgore?
1977.
So you've been there for a very long time then.
Oh, yeah. Over 30 years, yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
What have you seen change over those years in terms of the students?
It's hard to say because people ask me that, and I don't remember the students being any worse than they were when I came. But I remember when I first got here, I gave them basically a test that I give it to my eighth graders, but I will have to say this. I worked with my eighth graders more. It had essay on there. And so with my eighth graders, you know, we spend time, this is what you're going to write on this essay and stuff. Well, with this group, I just didn't do that. And I mean, hardly anybody passed that damn thing. And so I don't know. I can't tell that they've really gotten less quality. I wasn't paying any attention to it. I can't tell. The things that I think have changed, and this might just be selective memories, is I just got an email today. One an A in the class. Drives me crazy. Everybody was a damn A, you know?
I can relate to that.
You know, I always want to walk in the first day and say, how many want an A? Raise your hand. They don't ever tell me that again, you know? That's the end of that. But I think grade inflation, and it might be because I didn't come to a community college. I didn't have to worry about transferring anything.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to worry about grants, scholarships, because I was on the GI Bill. I couldn't, and so it may be more, but, you know, it's this great inflation from high school and everything. Well, they all, so many of them expect to get A's, and they're just not going to do it. That may be a little bit different, but, again, it might be selective memory. It seems to be more recently that I hear more about I got to have an A than when I first got over here. I've been lucky. I've always had good deans, good heads of departments. It didn't bother me. Let us do what we needed to do, and that was the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we all know this. I don't think we had a single part-timer when I first came. And of course, now we got them all over the place.
Right.
So there were things like that, but I can't tell from the students. They seem to be no different than they were. At least I don't remember that they're any different.
How did your time as a drill instructor affect the way you approach teaching?
All right, I'm going to tell you. Because as I tell people, you know, you can't hit them, you can't choke them, you can't do any of that. But I told eighth graders, I used to tell this to the faculty lounge, that we'd have a lot less discipline problems if on the first day after we called roll, we just killed one of them. We'd have some nice eighth grade scholars, you know? Just for the hell of it. Well, I don't care whether it is, just kill one of them.
Well, I'm pretty sure they won't allow that either.
No, they won't. They frown on that stuff. Well, you know, that was a Marine Corps attitude. You know, just shoot one of them to get it started, and you won't have to worry about it. And so, you know, I know I can't do that. When I was a DI, as soon as I left that platoon, I didn't take it anywhere with me or anything like that. I knew it was an act. I knew that. But I will tell you what it did do. I'm going to tell you this. Remember when I said as a DI you don't use notes?
Mm-hmm.
I ain't used notes from day one, ever. When I was student teaching, I don't care what it was, I never used notes. And if it was something I didn't know much about, because there were a lot of things like that. Like I said, I thought I knew history that I got into there and heard those professors and everything. And then after I got my bachelor's and got the job at West Rusk, I was terrified. I don't remember any of these things. I took the test and forgot it and went to the next course.
Mm-hmm.
So what I started doing is whatever is teaching, I would buy books on. And so I'm up at 3 o'clock at night reading what I'm going to be lecturing on the next day from the textbook. So where there was maybe one paragraph in the textbook, I've read 200 pages on it.
Right.
And I'm telling stories. And so that's the way I did it, but I never used any notes, ever used it. I just was not going to do that. So it had to be that Marine Corps drill instructor stuff. Because as I told people, if I had to use notes to teach it, then you can use notes to take the test. I don't use notes. And that's the one main thing. The other thing is teaching not exactly the same thing every year, but you still got 1301, 13, you still got that. But they let us change it up just a little bit. Well, how do you keep the enthusiasm? Because I have students to this day, you know, your enthusiasm and all that. And yet I've taught this for so long, and I learned this, I think, from being a drill instructor. I don't care how many times I taught what I'm teaching in that class today, it's the first time they've heard it.
Right.
And that's where my enthusiasm comes. And you do the best you can for those people in front of you right there, just like each one of these platoons. And I think those were the two biggest things. You don't use notes. You know your stuff before you go in there. If you don't, learn it before you go in there. And part of it, the enthusiasm was a different type, but graduating a platoon and then going back to square one, you had to start all over again, but you kept up the same enthusiasm. And I think that's what it was. This was their first time for it. And those are the two biggest things, being a drill instructor to teaching.
Well, what about you mentioned before that you didn't pay all that much attention to the progress of the war once you came back.
Uh-uh.
But I would think that there are some things that you inevitably would have had to pay attention to. You talked about the Tet Offensive.
Yeah, Tet Offensive.
What about
the
Tet Offensive, the fall of Saigon, the way the war was being was being prosecuted after you left? What were your impressions about that?
Well, really not a whole lot. Now, Tet Offensive, I knew it was bad. I knew it was bad and all that kind of stuff. And not long after the Tet, we got a guy in our fraternity that had been over there. He was in Tet. And I just asked him. I said, was it bad? Man, it was bad as hell. And that's all I said about that. And it's really that I wasn't keeping up with how I was being prosecuted. But when Nixon started bringing the troops home and stuff, we pretty well knew it was all over then. You know, if you had any sense about you, you knew we'd thrown in the towel. I graduated when the fall of Saigon took place. And I was working at Henderson Clay before I got my teaching job. And I remember I was going out there like 5:30 in the morning, had the car radio, and it told about the fall of Saigon. And you know, it got to me a little bit. You know, my God, you know, what a waste or something like that. I don't know. But I didn't keep up with it that much. I really didn't. You know, just every now and then I hear stuff on the news. But, you know, once Nixon started bringing the troops home, I pretty well knew it was all over. I did not believe a word of the Treaty of Paris, though, about how the North Vietnamese weren't going to take any more. I knew that was a bunch of bull. So I pretty well knew what was going. But it got to me a little bit, but not much. Not like maybe it ought to have.
Well, you were on a college campus during the last part of the Vietnam War. Now,
granted,
Stephen F. Austin is not Berkeley. It's not Columbia.
Yeah.
But what was the environment like as a Marine Vietnam combat veteran on the campus at Stephen F. Austin in the late 60s, early 70s?
Well, most time you didn't volunteer that you were a Vietnam veteran. I never denied it, but I never volunteered it because there were still some people down there, some of the students that didn't care a whole lot about it. And we had, especially girls, get up and walk off our table when they found out we'd been to Vietnam. Just get up and leave. So we didn't hide it, but we didn't advertise it. We wouldn't have put a bumper sticker on or anything like that. And as far as being a Marine veteran, you know, I was proud of it, but I was there to learn. I mean, I cannot believe how thrilled I was to be there just like another student. I didn't bring it up to anybody or anything like that. I didn't say, you know, why I was in the Corps or anything like that. And it's unbelievable, but I didn't do anything like that. We had a few war protesters there that, the guys down there now found that amusing, you know, that there were some war protesters down there. And I didn't have any bad feelings about them. You know, I really didn't. That was just, it, you know, I should have been over there, but I wasn't. And I remember telling them one time it was raining, if they go inside, they wouldn't get wet. And they said, well, it wouldn't mean anything if we did that. Well, I'm sorry, but you're getting wet out here. You know, that's a bad guy, man. You're holding the sign out here in the rain, just go in the building and hold the sign. Oh, it wouldn't be the same, man. It's, oh, okay, you know. Well, I didn't have any hostility against them or anything like that. I probably thought they don't know what you're talking about or something, but I didn't go over there and chew them out or anything like that. I guess the word mellow, I just completely mellowed out. You know, I wasn't there to impress anybody with all that or anything. I was just getting on my, and again, just getting on with my life and just glad to be home.
What do you think, when you look back on it, and with the perspective of someone who's taught history for, you know, 40 years, how do you think the Vietnam War and the Vietnam era shaped what the United States is today?
Oh, gosh. There's one direct thing. Now that, you know, they appreciate these veterans in Iraq and Afghanistan, which they certainly didn't do us, you know, welcoming them home in the airports and all that kind of stuff. I think that's direct because of the way they treated us. I think it's we're not going to do that again or something like that. I think we mentioned that last time. I think that, personally, as far as our leaders, it's like they never even heard of Vietnam. They didn't learn anything. I talked to my brother about Afghanistan and everything, you know, win the hearts and minds. You know, like, have we not heard this before? I don't know what else to do, but Afghanistan looks so much like Vietnam as far as the small units and going into the towns and stuff like that. I don't see, as a nation, we've learned a whole lot from it. I really don't. It's just like the mistakes that I think we made in Vietnam, these people don't remember any of that stuff. It's just, it seems like they're making the same things over and over again. It's amazing that it seems like, and I know they hadn't forgotten Vietnam, but it almost seems like they have. You know, you don't hear, and it's because of what's going on now, Iraq and Afghanistan. It just doesn't seem like, as a nation, we learned what happened in Vietnam, because most people don't have a clue what happened in Vietnam. They went and saw some movies, and that's all they know. I know my students, and if I would ask them, and they were honest, most of them would think we won the Vietnam War.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. But when I talked to the Vietnam class, I found out there were people that were shocked that we didn't win the Vietnam War. You know, what movie showed us losing that war? Yeah, that's unbelievable. Yeah, they think we won. Many of them think we won that war, but we never lost a war. So I think most people don't know enough, and the ones that, I don't think they've learned. They being the government, the people that make decisions, what happened over in Vietnam, what went wrong, and all that stuff. You know, and basically, I don't think we should even been there in the first place. Have you ever read a book called The Perfect War, The War We Couldn't Lose, and How We Did?
No, I've not.
Great book. Great book.
I'll write that down when I'm
sitting. I will. I've got it right over there. I'll tell you, send me an email and I'll send you the title and the author and the ISBN and everything.
Oh, terrific.
It is a great book. I mean, my God, it's a perfect war, the war we couldn't lose and how we did. And then Hackworth, you know, reading his stuff. I don't read personal accounts. I'd read a couple of them early. Mm-hmm. And some of them just sound like too much BS. And that wasn't me. There was this lieutenant that was a Marine over there. And I gave him one of them. And when he got through reading it, I said, was the guy BS? He said, oh, yeah, we both agreed. It was just because they just, you know, he may have been a vet. He may have been over there. And the editor may say, we want to sell books because he's doing things that just aren't, they're just not realistic. Like, he's the only Marine in that platoon that knows how to use an M79 grenade launcher. And he's the only one that knows how to use an M60. And that he had to take time to go over and literally save another platoon, but rather than getting any glory, he just waved to him in the battle smoke and went back. That's BS, in my opinion. The only one that knew how to fire an M79. So that's why I say, and it may have been the editor needed something or something. So anyway, I don't read much about what other people did over there. Like I say, I used to. Now, my Caputo's book, yeah, I read that. That's a great book.
Yes, excellent.
Yeah, that's a great book.
What about?
I read the guy that wrote The Things That They Carried. I know his name. He was in the Army. I'll think of it in a minute. Tim O'Brien. I read his book. But that's about it. And then some of these, like The Perfect War and stuff like that.
Well, tell me about the war and its effect on you personally. You've talked about how your time as a drill instructor has affected your approach to teaching, killing one student each semester, which is, you can debate the merits of that, I guess.
Well, yeah, and it doesn't mean you don't like them. Just kill one of them.
How has your time?
I didn't got to know you. I just shoot you,
How has your time as a Vietnam veteran, how has that affected you personally, Mr. Stroud?
I'm sure it has. Again, like I say, that even if I talk about it for a few minutes, I have trouble sleeping at night. I don't know why. But I know what you're talking about, but I think people don't realize, that I would never do it, but how easy it would be to kill one of these people, and I'm not going to do it or anything like that. I know that they don't have a clue what we went through, and that when they think they've had a rough day, they don't have a clue about what a rough day is. And I don't tell them that. And I'm going to tell you why I don't do it. When I was in high school, I wanted to go in the Marine Corps bad, mm-hmm. and I was reading Rumor Battle Cry, mm-hmm. and we had a shop teacher. And I'd come in, and the only book I carried was Battle Cry, Battle Cry, Battle Cry. And I told everybody I was going to the Marine Corps and all that. Well, he knew that. And for some reason, I don't know, maybe it had a bad night or something, and I came into shop, and I had Battle Cry with my notebook. He came over to me, and he took that Battle Cry book, and he waved it in my face, and he said, "This is a bunch of bullshit." And he walked off. Well, now I know what he's talking about. But I would never do that to anybody, I just wouldn't do it. It bothers, another thing, too, when I see these guys walking around in camouflage because they've been deer hunting or something and they got the kids in this camouflage, it just man, you people don't have a clue what this camouflage is all about. And I try not to be that way, but I can't help it. And I don't say anything to them, but it just gets to me, I don't know what it's pretend. I don't know what it is. I don't know how to explain it. Sometimes when I see them taking tests and everything, I think about, about the dead bodies and stuff that I saw. But basically, and I don't do that. Like, if I don't tell anybody, if you think you had a rough time, you ought to have been in bed. I don't do any of that because I didn't like anybody doing that stuff to me. And I'm just not going to do it. And although this didn't come up, I don't talk about what's going on to my students. I won't even answer a question about the Iraq War in Afghanistan. If they ask me what I think, I ain't telling them. And the reason is, these kids got family over there. Some of these guys have been over there. And I'm not going to stand up there and tell them what I think about it, one way or the other. That's their war. They have to make that decision. That's basically it. But a lot of times, it's like, because I'm... Right now, Kilgore College, I can't think of another Marine Vietnam vet or even an Army vet that was over there. And, and it's just like when I went back to that reunion, the things that we did, that these people don't have a clue about. They don't. And again, these students in there I'm teaching right now, they haven't got a clue of what I did in Vietnam. Not a clue. And that's kind of the way I want it, I guess. But it's always there with you. And I keep it back in the background, of course. But I don't tell Ward. I've talked 100,000 times more to you than I ever have about this stuff. I just don't do it. But it's always there. It's always there. Yep.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap this interview up?
I can't think of anything, and I'm sure there'll be 20 things after it. And I will tell you, you've done a great job. I really appreciate
it. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure.
I mean, because I told my brother when I heard about this, these damn wannabes, this is a feeding frenzy and all that stuff. And that's one thing I do not like of these damn people claiming to be in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. It just gets me because that makes me madder, I think, than anything. These guys that are standing up there and claiming to have been in Vietnam and all that kind of stuff. And I think the reason is because most of them are my age, and when they had a chance to go, they didn't go. Mm-hmm. And now they're up there claiming that they did. And the few people that I know here that I know without a doubt were in Vietnam, you wouldn't know it. You wouldn't know it. They never say anything about it. And one of them is a guy that was in the Army over there. And the reason I know he was over there is because at that time my wife and his wife were good friends. We were going over to his house. And my wife told me that don't ask Tom anything about Vietnam. That he was over there. And so when we got over there, I asked Tom about Vietnam.
Of course you did.
And what I said was, I said, hey, Tom, who were you with over there? And he told me he was with the Army. And when he was over there, and he was just a grunt and all that kind of stuff. That's all it is. That's all it is. And he's told me, I've seen him a couple of times, you know, that you know, he won't buy his son camouflage shorts or anything like that because of that. And so this one guy that I know, but most people working him would never know he'd been to Vietnam. And then there's one or two other guys like that. But then we got one down there. You know, we got some. That, I don't know if I told you this guy. I think he was in the service, and I shouldn't even say this. But I got introduced to him the first day. And as soon as he shook my hand, he's telling me war stories. Mm-hmm. And of course, what's he in 101st Airborne, right?
Of course.
101st. And he's telling me war stories from the day. And he may very well have been there. But the ones that I know that were there, they don't do that. And so I've gotten where I'm just, you know, if somebody tells me they've been in Vietnam, I just automatically don't believe them until I can satisfy myself. And sitting there telling me war stories isn't the way to do it. No. But I don't know. It's hard to say. It's with me every day. People around me don't know it. They'll never know it. And that's kind of the way I want to keep it. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know what you think about what I told you, but, you know, it doesn't sound that bad. But when you went through it, like, I could not count how many firefights were. And we didn't do that. And, you know, I remember parts of them and stuff. It affected me. It affected me. Not in a way that I can't handle it. You know, I held a good job and all that kind of stuff. But most people will never know. And that's basically it. They just don't have a clue what we went through. Just the heat and the walking and, you know, talking about how we kept people from getting heat stroke. My God, I don't know how we did that. The rumor war that one kid that got heat stroke or whatever. But it's just mainly what we went through, and they don't have a clue what we went through over there. That's about it.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Mr. Stroud, for your time and for your willingness to speak with me at such length about this.
I just appreciate you doing this. And like I say, you've done such a good job. You really have. I mean, because you know what to ask and all that kind of stuff. Because I didn't have a clue, you know, tell you about a couple of things. But, yeah, you've done an outstanding job.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, just.